I'm opening. We have an eye, part of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another X-Men special, because we did one last week where we talked about all the movies coming up to this one, X-Men Days of Future Past. Very excited to be here. We have on the panel Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans.
Sarah Stretton.
Hi, guys.
Welcome John, back, Sarah Stretton.
Thank you.
That's right.
John Comerford.
Hey, everybody.
And as promised, we have the film's composer, the film's editor, John Ottman.
Where am I?
There you go.
And we've even brought up Marissa Serafini out of the booth to join him on the couch to discuss this movie with us.
Hello, everyone. Hello, John.
Hi.
We've got quite the full team today.
And hello, John. Thank you very much for being here.
Yeah, appreciate you being here. Thanks
big,
for coming.
Big thrill. Big thrill for us.
This is
great to be here.
Are you pleased with it?
I think. I'm not sure. Oh, the movie?
Yeah. How do you like the way it turned out? Yeah?
Yeah. I always look at something and go,
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Are you able to look at any movie without doing that? I mean, are you?
Yeah, no, I can get taken into a film. Not completely, though. I still see the heads in front of me and the edge of the screen. I can never really completely forget where I'm at, you know. Mm-hmm. But I see most films on a plane because that's when I have the time to see them. And then I don't know. They say you get more emotional on planes, so I tend to cry a lot when I see movies on planes. I don't know.
But that was you?
Philomena is a wreck. know.
Do you think that, have you ever been able to just really get absorbed into a film? Do you think that's gotten, like, in a way worse as you've had more
now that you
years
know the sausage
industry?
Is made, do you ever go?
Well, you know, the funny thing is it's maybe it washes itself out because I don't see many movies at all because I'm so busy. And so when I go, it's kind of like, wow, you know, and like, you know, a lot of my friends are so jaded to see every film and they're like over the 3D thing. I'm like, I love it. You know, it's like, I just, you know, it makes it more fun for me. So, cause I just don't get out much. So in that regard, I kind of enjoy going to see a film in kind of a weird way.
Do you?
Unless there's some composer that got the movie that I didn't and I get pissed off.
Well, that's a great question. Do you find yourself, cause a lot of times some people end up, they're sort of jaded. Because, like, you know, you're an editor, you're a composer. Do you ever go to a movie and go, what the hell were they thinking when they edited this together this way? Or, like, does it ruin the experience for you?
Even as an editor, the editing's hard because you don't really know what was under the hood,
what
they had to deal with and so forth. I mean, I can tell if something's really poorly done and I see an opportunity lost on the screen that I clearly know they could have done, that's frustrating. But you don't notice that as much. As an editor, it's really hard to judge editing by just looking at a movie, but in a general way, you can kind of make a judgment. Score wise, you can, you know, I'm like, whoa, really? How did that get through all the mixers and the producers and they're like, cool, this is great, you know, really? I mean, how did it get there, you know? But, you know, especially like I said, if it's a film I really would love to have done and the score sucked, it's really hard and frustrating, you know? But there's also composers out there who I hate to love, like Desplat, you know, it's like, I love his music, and so he gets every movie in town, but at least he's good, and so I feel better that, okay, at least he did a good job, you know.
Well, then spill the beans. What was a project that, what was a movie that you saw, and you're like,
well, I can't think of one specifically, but he sort of I sort of had a wheelhouse that I was in for a while with, like Suspects and movies that no one saw, unfortunately, though, like Incognito and even Moments About People, which even though they're sinister, they sort of have a lyrical, piano-driven quality, and that sort of was a strength of mine, and then I kind of went off and did other stuff, and so he kind of, you know, made that his wheelhouse, which it is, you know, and so when I see a film like that, I'm like, that's kind of what I kind of do naturally, but don't really get that opportunity.
Do you know him?
No.
Because we've talked about him
at length,
only because, you know, he did Philomena, Monuments Men, the recent Godzilla.
Right.
And he seems to almost be a chameleon. He just does so many different kinds of scores. But you as well, I think so, before we started this taping, I was talking about what brought me in recognizing you is Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Mm-hmm. Right. And you did this amazing score where you were jumbling all these different kinds of like genres, like noir, caper film, like throwback to the 30s, 40s. Like, how was that for you in working with Shane Black? And
I had a blast on that. I mean, that's one of my favorite film experiences, film composing experiences, you know. And I think he thought I hated the movie. He wrote these really cool liner notes for me on the CD. Did you read those?
I did.
He does this whole psychoanalysis of me, and I'm like, holy crap, I got to be careful about how I present myself now, because he writes this whole thing how he was sure I hated the movie. But when I go in to see a film, I'm thinking about what I need to do, you right. know, and so I'm not just watching the film. And so I kind of must have walked out saying, okay, you know, because I was in this sort of, you know, but then when I cracked it, because I didn't know what to do, because there wasn't really tempt with much at all. And so, which is good. So I can go to bed at night knowing I wrote this thing that came from my head and not feel like I had to rip anything off. But, when I found the theme, you know, right. and the funky thing that I came with these percussion tracks at him, and I sent it to Joel Silver, and he was like, I love it! You know, I play with my car every 5 minutes, my wife hates me, you know, so.
That's a very good Joel Silver.
Oh yeah, you gotta do this, like, yeah, exactly. You know. But, so then I was excited because it was sort of like a relief. Okay, I found my groove, and so then I just had a great time with it, you know.
Yeah, and you seem to have a really great time on that. And again, it's one of my favorite films.
Did you have a great time on Unusual Suspects? Because that's still in my top 10.
Yeah.
I don't remember it being a great time, but I mean, I don't remember it being a bad time either. Just sort of like, I don't think it was sort of, I didn't know what we were really doing. It's like, I just saw that sort of a glorified student movie because I didn't know who any of the actors were. Cause even then I never saw films really that much because I was watching the Star Trek, you know?
Sure.
And, but which is good because I didn't have an association of who those actors were with any other prior parts or roles. So I just saw them as the characters they were. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were cutting that film in my living room, you know, in the valley, and so I just, you know, and also we didn't have any, the studio didn't have a final cut or anything, so it was just like, we're going to make this movie, and if we like it, then we hope everyone else does, and of course that's great when you can do that, and not have to rely on test screening results and so forth.
One thing I know that we've talked about here a lot when it comes to score is, some composers seem to stray away from doing themes, but not you. You will do a theme to a character. You know, you do it in this X-Men movie. In fact, there's even Hope. It's called Xavier's theme.
Yeah, I don't.
You do it in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Well, I do it because I don't know how I need to establish something that I'm drawing from for the score. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would just be in a fog. I'd be lost. I wouldn't know where I'm going. I need to, you know, the character themes I write beforehand. So I know where the film's coming from and where the character is coming from. And it's not like every character walks in the room, suddenly a theme plays. That'd be goofy. But I, you know, so when you say character theme, at least you mean you're creating some sort of thread for the audience to identify with either a storyline, a theme in the movie, not musical theme, but a theme for a thing that's
concept
of the film, right? You know, and then the X-Men theme is basically just for instance, for X-Men, it's an overall thing that represents the whole world of the X-Men. You know?
Was it easier for you to score this type of film, considering you worked already on X-Men 2?
Yeah, well, it wasn't.
Or do you have
I can't say it was easy
of?
Because this was. I mean, if this had just been a, you know, the next follow-up to X-Men 2 back in that time, I would have done the same kind of score as X-Men 2, very lyrical and traditional and so forth. But this was the idea for this one was to do that, but also make it be more modern and to contend with the Nolan-esque kind of movies. So I think Brian was a little paranoid about feeling too nostalgic because on Superman Returns, we were very nostalgic for the 78 version. And we're kind of like in a rut in that movie because if we didn't do that, we would have been fried.
You got land-based that crazy.
Exactly. Yeah. And we believed in that movie so much. And
it's not bad if you're using that source material.
So we had to do that. And, you know, and then so we were kind of in this. But anyway, so because of that, I think he was afraid of going back to the X-Men 2 theme because, oh, it's a pass. But I kept saying that it's contextual. The film is new. The film is dark. And so it will update the theme by default. And I felt I was always pissed off that the other films didn't use that theme, so yeah. We're glad to have it back.
You mentioned, if I may, just go back a little bit, because one of my questions, too, that I had was about Superman Returns, and it is such a love letter to the 1970, to the Richard Donner vision and whatnot. And your score, too, is fantastic, where you use Williams a key, like you just put it in key points, but mm-hmm. How hard was that to balance for you? Because you don't want to do... If you did a complete John Williams rehash, people will go, it's just the John Williams.
It's the Ken Thorne thing.
Right. Yeah. So how do you, like, interject yourself, and how hard was that to balance?
Well, I tell the story. At first, I was just paralyzed because I would get the death threats on the internet. Like, you know, if you don't use a John Williams theme like I had not intended to, and then or why the hell are you scoring this movie, you know? And so when I went to start writing, I was just sort of like, I was so paranoid about doing the wrong thing for other people. And then finally I just said, can I say fuck
it? Yeah.
I said, because I do it all the time. Yeah. But I said, fuck it. I just have to, like, just look at this movie and pretend that I wrote the Superman theme as my well to draw from as the main theme of the film, and just score the movie like I normally would. And so that's what I did. And then the Superman score is so ingrained in my head, I never had to refer to any of the scores of his or anything, because it just came out.
That's
so
great.
So I just scored it like I would a normal movie. And I think even Brian was surprised how many little nods I did. But the frustrating thing is there's like 115 minutes of score in that film, and I think some people think, oh, it was basically a rehash of John Williams.
And
it's just sprinkled with that. But I mean, there's a lot of stuff I wrote,
The jet sequence score is one that comes to mind.
Well, I guess it's a backhanded compliment, too, because it blended so nicely. So
right. Yeah, I get to do new themes, like for Lex Luthor and so
forth. Yeah, no, it was great. Now, what... Have you always been, like, did you always enjoy scores, like growing up watching movies?
That's all I listened to. I was a total freak. All I did is watch Star Trek and listen to film music, and then I wanted to expand upon that, so I went to Tower Records one day, and I asked the guy in the classical section, can you give me all the classical pieces that sound like film music? And so he, you know, got me Holst the Planets, and then Symphonia Antarctica by Vaughan Williams, and then, the Ninth Symphony by Dvorak. And so then I would go watch those symphonies be performed at the San Jose Symphony, because I grew up in San Jose. And that's how I played the clarinet for years, too, so I did, you know, read music, but I would just watch what I had known, and that's how I learned a lot.
What was your first score album? Do you remember walking into a Tower of Music Land?
Oh, that I bought?
Yeah, that you bought.
I mean, it had to have been Star Wars, but I can't remember specifically.
For me,
product of that, you know, where you're like...
I'm going to switch gears because we got to get to the movie. I want to know more, because I also want to hear about Jerry Goldsmith and the influence he had over you and stuff like that. But let's get into the movie.
You know, in terms of X-Men, how were you kind of introduced into the, you know, universe? I mean, you know, you're just kind of working with Bryan Singer and all that, you know, kind of following along with him. But what's your kind of, with the comics, there's the TV series, there's, you know, been the movies.
Yeah, I didn't know anything about X-Men until we dove into X-Men, basically researched all the characters on the internet. I don't know, can't remember if it was Wikipedia back then, if that was even exist. I looked somewhere on the internet.
2000?
But anyway, I researched them all, and you know, what made them tick and what their... I always have to know what the angst is of a character, because that's where I draw my stuff from. So, the character, that world is so great, and what it represents, of course, to especially a person who's gay, whatever. And then on top of that, the actors who are playing those roles, you know, where, you know, we talk about, you know, McKellen and Patrick Stewart could just read the phone book and be like, wow, you know, so it just, for all those reasons, it makes it a really exciting place to be. And so it's just inspired me, you know.
Very cool. Now, sorry, my mic is just killing me. I can't hear you. I know in the booth they say it's good.
Yeah. I can hear you.
I feel like I'm muted for this whole thing. You know, I know with this movie, Donner said, like, there's 40 years worth of material, but they really wanted to do Days of Future Past, and that they really wanted to kind of do what Nolan did with, you know, you actually referenced it when you were talking earlier, where this would be like the Nolan's Dark Knight.
Right.
You know, it would be much darker, unlike where First Class was kind of like Batman Begins. You got to know the characters.
Right.
With this, you guys can get right into it. And it was Matthew Vaughn who said, you know, he loved it. One of the funniest things to me about the movie is the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
Because that was like, for them, a golden nugget of like, let's start on this piece of event. I mean, in terms of, you know, the way we kind of do things here, we start with the development. So, you know, what backstory can you give us in terms of the development, the conception of getting into this movie and, you know, taking it to be a sequel for two movies, essentially?
Well, my development really starts as pre-production is ending. I come on where we're starting to design, or the previous department has already begun designing some sequences that we're going to shoot later. Then I come on and start designing new ones with them and storyboarding big sequences that are to come.
Right.
And so that consumes the first part of arriving. And that never ends, because we'll be shooting and getting floods of material for me to assemble. But at the same time, I've got to be storyboarding sequences for things we have to shoot later. Mm-hmm. And then animating those storyboards, the previs, of course. And then I even do sound and music on those, and do dialogue on top of the things, so that we're like, I'm like, here, shoot this, you know. But so that's because
so you're doing music as well as all that other stuff.
No, I'm not doing music yet. Oh, I mean, there's no chance in hell I could be writing any music at that point. Because on top of the storyboarding of the sequences with the previous department and coming up with those animated things, while I'm trying to assemble the things that we're shooting, I'm missing parts, I'm missing beats, or I don't like certain things. And so Brian gives me the authority to write a shot list out, and he basically tells the producers, whatever John wants, we're going to shoot somehow. So then it becomes, how do we shoot all this? And so I'll either go off with a splinter group, or I'll have second unit go shoot something, or we'll decide to have first unit go shoot something that I want. Or, and then, of course, they'll see the shot list, and they'll panic in the morning, and they'll call me down at 6 in the morning when I've been working till 1, and so it's that kind of thing is pretty overwhelming.
You described editing this movie as a whack-a-mole kind
of
a project.
Yeah, well, on top of all that, you got a time travel film where, you know, like I said, it's whack-a-mole. You whack one and you got another problem. And so that was an issue as we were shooting. And and I have this vested interest more than anybody on the movie to make sure the film works, because I can't get back to LA and have a problem child, because I got to write a score.
Yeah.
And so my editor's cut is usually around the running time of the film. And, and I need to believe, even though it's never that way, but I need to believe that this cut is releasable. And the only way I'm going to get that cut when I return to LA and have my editor's cut is if, when we're shooting, I have some sort of clairvoyance as to what's going to happen later and solve it now. And that happened a few times on this film, where we'd shoot a scene and I'd be like, this doesn't make any sense. It's never going to be in the film. And so we'd actually shoot another scene in lieu of that, which is a huge expense, but not nearly the expense if we
had to go
back later. And in the small amount of pickups that we had to do on this film, we barely were able to get them because of actors' schedules. And so we never would have been able to get some of those sequences.
So if somebody were to come back to you and say, hey, I got this great time travel movie, I want you to, like, would you just say, no way?
Well, first of all, I would say no to anybody who wants me to go edit a movie, except for Brian, who makes me do it.
Yeah. Right.
But, so and then we get back, it's endless logic debates, and you have a lot of cooks in the kitchen, and a lot of my time was just exhaustively trying to create consensus.
Yeah. Well, with Brian,
everyone say, "Okay, this is what we all believe, right? This is what we're on the same page, right? Okay." Before the chairman walks in, this is what we're all together on this, right? Okay, you know.
But because of your working relationship with the director Brian Singer, how much creative input and directorial kind of choices do you have in making films with him?
Well, I mean, we're great creative partners. So, I mean, it's trust factor over, 20-something years. So if I say, you know, I really think we've blown it on this, I mean, he's going to listen to me, you know, and vice versa. So it's, you know, and you get that shorthand where, remember in that movie where we had that problem? Oh, yeah. Okay, well, we've got this problem again, you know. So it's it allows him to, like a lot of directors, to go enjoy their lives while, you know, I destroy mine at an avid, you know. I'd say the editors basically enable the lifestyle of their directors, you know, by destroying their own.
Do you have any examples from X-Men for this film that you made some big changes or scenes that you really had to, like, flip on their heads or anything?
Well, I mean, that one example of shooting a scene and then, and even though I bumped on it in the script, but you kind of like, oh, maybe it's going to be okay, but it wasn't. And it was a scene where Raven comes back. He's looking for Raven in the Cerebro. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a funny moment, but where it goes, this doesn't make sense, is where he's like looking for, and he has a definer. He's like, he takes off the helmet and goes, yeah, she's in the kitchen. And so they go in the room, and there she is. She's home, which is like, that's a cool idea. But then you're thinking as you're watching the scene, which was a terrible scene already, and it's god-awful location. It looked like it was like a $2 million movie, this kitchen scene, this kitchen set or house they found somewhere. But I was like, well, the movie's over. Why doesn't Logan just lock the doors and say, okay, you can't go anywhere. Okay, mm-hmm. Call me back to the future now. I've done my job. It's like, yeah. I tell you where... It's like, what? So, and on top of that, this wasn't a great scene. So I'd like, you know, she can never come back. You know, he's got to contact her somewhere else, like in an airport. And then they wrote this whole airport scene. So, that was probably the most crazy example, because to go shoot that scene mm-hmm. was a big deal, mm-hmm. you know, and Brian yeah. had to go to Fox and say, yeah. look, this doesn't work, you know, so.
Many people have talked about that being a great scene, though, how he's yeah. talking to all these other characters and then he shows up.
It turned out to be a great thing.
Fabulous.
I love it.
So
yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. yeah. And just threw that together really fast. I mean, Simon cranked that out and wow. and they went and shot it. And so when I got the dailies back, I'm like, how the hell did they do all that? You know, yeah. and they got these bit actors that were like really good. They
yeah.
the stewardess lady and, yeah. you know, and the woman mm-hmm. sitting down. They're great.
Right.
You
know? Yeah. It's a great scene.
It really is.
You looked like you had.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you're talking about time travel, and Bryan Singer had this conversation with James Cameron. Did you ever get, like, kind of notes about time travel and multi-universes from either
string
one of them?
No, we gave the film to James Cameron when we basically had an editor's cut that had been around for a while, and he saw that, and you know, I mean, maybe he hated it, but he actually said he loved it, so then... And he said he loved the cross-cutting between future and past, which, mm-hmm. of course, was a constant battle with the studio, because they were always confused, like where are we now? I'm like, well, let's see. It's a lawn, and there's a robot that looks like it's kind of...
And Nixon.
Yeah. I would say we're in 1973.
Right. They really had challenges with that? Okay, sorry. Never mind. Sorry.
That says it all.
Wow. You know, and that became... I mean, the third act was recut millions of times, because my original intercut was very...
Ping-pong.
Yeah, it's back and forth and juxtapositions that of shots that look just like each other back
oh,
and
nice.
Forth. And it was sort of, you know, but it was just way too head exploding for people. So we kind of we stayed in future and past.
So did you
longer.
Change the – because I remember there was that one shot of Storm where it's kind of going up. And then cuts back to the Sentinel.
Yeah. That was an original holdover from mm-hmm. one of the juxtapositions that I planned, because mm-hmm. this was all pre-vised out. You know, and storyboarded for these shots yeah. to sort of reflect each other. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't really, you know, it wasn't editorially jacking off. It was just sort of like really cool how it all, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I took from that because, again, I thought those scenes were brilliant because you were showing a parallel between the past, the future,
right.
and how those actions were happening simultaneously within that wormhole, so to speak. And,
right.
I thought they were great. Who is this executive of?
Well, I mean, it's you know, not just one executive. It's you yeah. know, it's a you have friends and family screenings, and you know, and people react, and you know, it's the 11 and 12 year olds who are explaining the movie to
yeah, I know, exactly.
the older people, and I'm not kidding.
No, I believe.
We this happened on X-Men 2. We showed the film to a little private screening, and Tom Rothman stood up, who was the chairman of the studio at the time, and he's like, you know, it's just like. People can be really baffled by this thing. It's really confusing. And his 11-year-old daughter stood up. She goes, Daddy, I understood the whole thing. So she stood up, and she proceeded to explain the alternate realities and what he's really seen and who's not there, and the whole movie. And then that was it. She diffused a journey, a journey of hell we could have gone down.
And wow. she's now running Universal?
Yeah. I mean, but I was always like, where is this little girl?
They need to plant her in every screening.
We went around circles a lot, but even in the little tests we had, it was the little kids understood every little nuance. You mm-hmm. know, it's amazing. You know.
Wow.
Because they have the willingness to, like, believe, and they just, like, let everything happen.
But they weren't confused by anything either. It's like, yeah. you know, and it's... people our age or my age.
Well, I think we're all kids at heart here. I mean, I wasn't finding it. No, I love those sequences and how they were done. And
Yeah, I feel like the younger generation can suspend their disbelief easier than the adults, because the adults will go into a film and think all of the logistics of it.
Right, yeah.
And then they won't enjoy the experience as much as a young person would.
Yeah.
They look at it from different eyes, though. I mean, I come from the world of distribution and such, and they have what are called trade screenings. And trade screenings are basically set up for exhibitors. And exhibitors look at movies very boringly, I think, for the most part. There's a handful who get it, but for the most part, they're looking about, am I going to put this in a 500-seat house, a 250-seat house? How long is this going to run for?
Yeah.
And there's usually very little reaction. Sometimes I hate going to those because there's no audience participation.
Well,
but yeah, and it's
well,
all studio.
A lot of times the marketing people at a studio can actually determine the fate of a movie and the making of that movie. Well, Jack the Giant Slayer was one. It started out to be a very kind of a dark movie, and which it should have remained as such. But you know, the marketing people were like, "Oh, this has to be for every single person on earth, from a toddler to a 90-year-old," and so we have to make it more colorful, and so we enhanced the color and made it more. And so then when you do that to a film, it sort of doesn't know what it is anymore.
Right, yeah.
Nothing
for nobody.
But by them saying that, it changed the making of the movie in post, you know.
Now, how about it? We'll go back to X-Men. We were talking again about studio involvement. How involved? I know you had a little issue back with the score for Halloween H2O, where a particular studio sort of kind of took things out of your hands. If I'm misspeaking, you let me know. Mm. But in this movie, so. In fact, the soundtrack was released as Portrait of Terror, inspired by H2O. It's a great soundtrack, by the way. But now going into X-Men Days Future Past, Time's Up is the one track that what I was reading about. And there were two versions. I call it a bonus track. There were two versions on that. Right. One says film version.
Right. So I want everyone to know on the album, okay, this was the one I intended.
Right.
And then here's the one that everyone wanted. Well, this was not really a case of studio interference at all.
Yeah.
It's just that, this opening sequence is an action sequence. I wanted it to be unique and different, like the White House sequence in X2, because that scene was like, I wanted that scene to feel like more than an action sequence, so I struggled musically with that scene in X-Men 2 until the idea of the Mozart piece came with this amped up with anvils and snare drum Mozart piece. Yeah. And sort of makes it sort of this standalone special sequence. And that's what I wanted to do with the opening action sequence in this film. And I just couldn't figure out what that would be. I looked for classical pieces, that didn't work. And so then I thought, well, what if I do like a Carmina Burana kind of a gothic, you know, malevolent kind of choir kind of piece. And I did it and showed it to Brian, and he was like, "That's cool, I think," you know, because it was so different.
Right.
And so I went, recorded it. Everyone's jazzed, and I brought him down to watch that one scene, and he was like on board. But the great thing about working with star director is that, or someone who's basically looked at the Godfather of this franchise, is we can just work together, and if we're happy, then the studio, in a way, doesn't have much of a choice. But we're very respectful of what they want, and we do it. But this particular scene was just kept insular, kept internal. So on the final playback of the film, the final playback of the sound, where we're done with the movie, studio sees it, and they're like, "Whoa, this isn't like it was," you know, because the temporary score was very typical, just action music, and Brian's like, "Yeah, maybe you're right," you know. So then we threw up the temporary music on the stage, a place that everyone's familiar with and comfortable with, and I knew the moment we did that I was screwed. But we were print mastering in 3 days.
Right.
Print mastering is where, you know, it's like shipped out the door.
Oh yeah.
In fact, we had already shipped out the door for China and Vietnam, so they have the old version. But it was like the Dolly and zoom out moment where I'm thinking, sure, I can have something on a recording stage in like 3 days.
And yeah, because once you get that IN.
The day, and so, anyway, so I was on a couch, laying on my orchestrator's couch for 48 hours, and I was like, okay, you know, so we wrote this thing, and we had, actually, the funny story is we had no time to get the whole choir back. So I and my two orchestrator guys sang the choir for like 5 bars. So that's what's in the movie. And I have a video of it. So at some point, I'm going to put it on my website. It's hilarious, you know. So we just multi-tracked ourselves.
Is temp love like a thing you face a lot of? Like is that the term, right? Temp love?
Temp love, yeah.
Where people just fall in love with the temp score and it's like you can't change it no matter what. It's like, no, yeah. But this is better.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm sort of the fox in charge of the chicken coop a little bit on that when I'm the editor, because I create the temp score, so I'm my own worst enemy. But and then I get intimidated by my own temp score, and I'm like, I can't do better than this. But in this regard, I wanted to go 180 degrees. I never really thought it was the right. I wanted to do something more. Anyway, so that's what happened. But on the day of our printmaster, we had a recording session, so it can't get that closer than that, because we basically recorded that morning, mixed it that day, flew it over the dub stage, and mixed it into the film, and like 2-3 in the morning we were done. And,
yeah, I was going to say, those post guys at the studio must have been like, oh my god. Like, yeah.
Well, I remember when that conversation happened, when we were watching the playback, right. The president of the production's like, I don't think he can do that.
That's crazy. So, has there ever been, like, do you choose your battles? Have you ever, like, fought the good fight to say, you know what, this really should stay in? Or do you just say, okay, whatever you say, we'll change? Or
it's pretty much hard for me to say, okay, whatever you say. I mean, because I especially when I'm the editor with Brian on a film, because it's like we're a team, and I'm very passionate about giving up a year or two of my life, and if I'm going to do that, it's going to be something I want to be happy with. And it's, to me, it's like in the creative world, there is no right or wrong, but there actually is for me. And it's like, no, there's a right way and there's a wrong way, and if that's wrong, I'm going to fight for what I think is right. You know.
Okay. So with X-Men, in terms of Jack and the Giant Slayer, you know, you guys kind of had to. There was nothing else before that, so you kind of had to sculpt it for what it was. With X-Men, obviously, there's such a rich history, and so although you're beholden to, let's say, the studio, but you're more beholden to the fans. And so how do you kind of juggle that responsibility of, you know, making sure, Dimitri has great, like, Easter eggs and things like that. Like, how do you know what to keep of, like, if we lose this, the fans will be absolutely pissed.
That was me. That was always my rationale for keeping something. Remember the fans, because you want to you got to try anything you can to convince them to do something, you know. But having said that, there was no they who weren't into what the fans wanted. I mean, I think everyone was very concerned about, like, making them happy, and because we're all fans too, you know. And then there was an apprentice editor in my editing room who was like the consummate authority on X-Men, you know. So I'd go to him and go, how would you feel if we did this? He goes, oh my god, no, you know. So it was great to have him around, and also the other guys in the office, they were all X-Men fans. I think that's the main thing we take to heart, of course, you know.
I mean, if I can applaud kind of everyone's efforts on the movie, Sarah and I saw it with our friend Roxy Stryer, who also does, you know, this every now and then, and she had never been introduced to the X-Men universe. But she came out of that movie loving it, understood everything, and was like, I now have to see every movie
there
that's come before
people.
This.
Can you email them for me? Because that was a concern. I mean, there was talk about having an opening sequence which shows Magneto, he controls metal. Mystique, she does this.
No.
And I'm like, no. You can't. But that was talked about, you know.
I'm sure it was.
Because it was a concern, because they want this film to be
as broad as it can be.
Right. And so we really wanted to really bring in some fresh blood into the audience, you know. But, thank God that we didn't do that.
I love the humoristic moments where, like, there's the moment where Wolverine goes through the metal detector, but he's in the 70s and he didn't have his operation
yet.
And there's just that quick look. But anyone who has seen those movies beforehand would obviously get that joke.
Exactly,
so, like,
right.
What other kind of jokes did you say, hey, we have to have this kind of thing in so everyone could appreciate this?
Think offhand.
We finally stumped them.
Well, it's hard to think of jokes that specifically relate to a fan knowledge. You know, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of jokes in the film that I fought for that aren't fan based. They're just jokes, you know, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. banter to keep character going. But
you're gonna clean all that up. One of those, is that one of them? When
Hugh Jackman's awesome because he
this is when they're in the plane and Magneto just crushed the plane.
That's an ad lib from him.
No, was it really?
Because, and then the Fassbender just plays along with it, you know. Yeah. And it's like I love those moments because mm-hmm. Hugh Jackman completely understands his character so well, and the script and the story, you can tell because we'll be doing a scene and he'll just come out with a line. I'm like, that shows me he really is keyed into what the story's about. And in fact, sometimes he'd do an ad-lib line after we've shot the other side of the scene. Mm-hmm. And the ad-lib line's so good, it means, we got to have that character react to the line and bring the person back, you know. Uh-huh. So.
What a stroke of genius. Like, you just go, we think our luck is, you had a great cast. And, you know, Patrick Stewart, Ian McKellen, you get great people in this, right? But Hugh Jackman, he's the linchpin. I mean, like, he's been in pretty much all of these movies in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
Do you guys just go, thanks, Hugh? Like, it's so great that, the number one, he's a fan. I've seen him do publicity, like, for all the movies, and, like, you know, he'll do something silly as put two forks in between and pose with kids, and.
Yeah. Well, first of all, he's like the nicest person on earth. Mm-hmm. You could be some homeless bum on a street and corner him, and he'll probably talk to you for an hour. He's just that kind of guy. Yeah. You know? And he really cares about the movie from day one. And like I said, I'm repeating myself, but he's just into it. And he's also so affable. So as a character, it's just a blessing that he is the, like you said, the sort of thread throughout the film, because he's sort of he's the anchor.
Yeah.
For you feel comfortable with this character.
In this day and age, to me, what I find amazing about that, it's rare that you'll find an actor who will want to continue to go on playing, you know, this one character, but he always brings something new to it, and he doesn't seem to complain. I think he's
an egoless person who just, I think, you know, despite that he's had a lot to do with his success because he's great, but I think he just feels very, I think I'm just speaking for him. I think you can tell he feels very blessed to be doing what he's doing. And I think he just never forgets that each day. And that's my analysis of him. And so I think he's just thrilled to be doing what he's doing. You know?
Liner notes from John Ottman.
Yeah, right.
But I think it's great also from everybody else that was involved. I mean, I really hate when things get recast and it's so easy to do that. But even just you know, Halle Berry in this movie, she didn't, you know, in terms of story, she didn't really have too much to do, but I still appreciated, like, you know, seeing all the familiar faces of the past and, you know, the new.
Yeah, well, that was one of the things going in we knew would be a challenge, is so many characters.
That's
what
I thought was your biggest challenge. I mean, you'll...
Apart from time travel, you have to do all this.
There was more for that. I mean, they did say things, but just that we had to cut it out because it's just, I mean, there's a lot of exposition to sort of establish the rules and what our plan is, la la la, and even the plan scene is like, there's a whole other part of that where then they all start talking and debating, and you're like, that's cool, but oh my god, I know that we just gotta get on with it, you know, it's like, because then she's gotta take him to the room, put him on the table, and give him more rules, it's like, and so we just had to make that call where we just, and the negative of it is that we had to cut out any dialogue that these characters, a lot of them, like Blink and Bishop and Sunspot, had some things to say, you know. But
was amazing is you were able to keep some great character moments. I mean, throughout, you had McAvoy having a fabulous, you know, finding hope again.
Well, then the whole movie's about McAvoy's character. I mean, Charles Xavier finding his hope, that's the whole movie.
Yeah.
And so that's why he got his own theme and so forth, which was fun to do, but... yeah, he's great in the film. Yeah.
I thought it was a great balance in terms of all the characters and keeping at least enough in there to make all those character beats and arcs work and still have all the characters in it, because I was looking at this going, how is he going to make this work?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, it's frustrating for me because I want to see more than myself, but I know that for the good of the film, we couldn't have done it. Yeah. You know, for DVD, all that stuff, we can see all that stuff.
There's another scene in particular too that many have said, and I think we all agree here, the Quicksilver scene.
Right.
Okay.
Who would have thought that? Because that was I wouldn't say it was a last minute addition, but he wasn't in the script originally. It was it used to be this guy who just jumped out of a plane and just went straight down to the Pentagon and then just got him out, you know. And so he was a late addition. So we were trying to previs that sequence when we were already overwhelmed with other scenes. It was the kitchen scene was the last, very last thing we shot. Shot that and left.
It was.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when we brought him into the script, there was this pressure. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff I don't pay attention to. Like, I didn't know Marvel was doing theirs, and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, Brian knew that. It's like, you know, they're doing theirs, and we got to make sure this is the most awesome thing ever, you know, that, you know, and it has to be fantastic. So we're, you know, sitting there with the previs guy going, okay. And I can't say that the slow mo thing was not an idea. It was the previs artist's, concept. And, but we put that together very quickly and animated that and then, and, you know, I can't take credit for the song, unfortunately.
Oh, that I'd was my to, next question.
I would love to take credit for it, but the previs artist put that in and I'm like, that is perfect, you know, and, but you never know if the song that's working on the animated version of the scene is going to ever translate to when we actually shoot it. Cause often that doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, most times the music they put in the previs is terrible and does no relation to what is ever going to be in the movie. But when I put the scene together editorially and put that song back on, I was hoping, and it worked great.
Yeah, again, it's being touted or said about being one of the best action sequences people have seen.
Well, and the funny thing
is,
it's not, if you really watch it, it's not really an action sequence because it's really a guy just walking through a hall with a tray.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard to, and there really wasn't, I would say much of a plan for his journey throughout there and how he gets them out. Right. And so a lot of the shots meant for the security cameras I actually used because there was very little coverage in the hallway where he comes out and the elevator opens and so forth. But so if you look at it, there's not a whole lot going on.
Right.
And so it's really about the music kind of giving this sort of like heisty feel and keeping the rhythm going and making you kind of amped up.
Well, I would
up,
say give yourself some credit too, because I thought the editing too, and the way that that works. Have you had the opportunity to see this movie with an audience?
Yeah, I haven't actually. The premiere. I went to the premiere.
Yeah, when I saw this movie last week, and I saw it in like a prestige, large screen format, 3D, it looked amazing. But that scene when it was done, just
applause.
It's
great. I mean, and we had applause even in our little internal screenings.
Yeah,
Friends of family, where it's just friends of the executives and family members.
It has to make you feel great.
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw his wig, I was like, oh my god,
we're
screwed.
How do I edit that out?
We're screwed. You know, Brian actually took me to the wig guy. John doesn't like the wig. I'm like, well, thanks for throwing me into the bus with the wig guy after we've already shot. There's nothing we can do about it now. It's like, so I'm sorry, I hate the wig. What am I supposed to see? What is he supposed to do now? You know, but you know what? It's contextual. If you love the character, you love the wig. You know, so.
Well, I'm with you. I didn't like it.
I wasn't
either.
Really affected by the wig. If I think about it really hard, I'm like,
eh. And here's the thing. I don't notice things like that because I know more in X-Men 2, people are complaining about Jean Grey's wig, and I'm like, she's wearing a wig? I would never know that. So if I'm noticing a wig, you know. But.
Yeah. But what was it like working with the visual effects editors during that whole Quicksilver kitchen scene? Because there was a lot of heavy visual effects in that. Where did you have to work with them a lot?
No.
Of course,
because that sequence is like the editing really ends at one point because there's only so much I can do. I mean, basically, the only editing in that slow-mo section is really getting him to run up on the wall, you know, which the stunt guy can only do for a very small amount of time, and we slowed it down, of course, and so and then it just basically cutting together the character beats of that, but all the junk and the crap all around, that's just something that I had to imagine, and then we sit down with the visual effects editor and we decide, okay, there's going to be a spoon here, there's going to be a pot over there, you know, and then the visual effects team already has a plan in motion because of the previs that's been designed.
Yeah,
you know?
And they come in and fix them.
Yeah, but it can be a brain explosion because you just, for the longest time, well, here's what's funny. Even before there was any stuff in there, and it's a green screen like a pot on a bar back there and everything, it got
applause
on our test screenings, you know, and I'm like, wow, they're not even seeing anything and they're loving it. Because I think it's the idea that they just respond to.
It is, I mean...
Well, it's quirky. It's fun. It's not
nothing
like
we've seen.
Exactly.
But it's like... But and X-Men a wedgie, so you're going to get fans' reaction from that. Yeah. Like the simple, funny, physical humor in that, and somewhat of a slapstick in it of itself in that scene as well. Yeah. Which
and,
had big...
You know, I've never had the opportunity to ask like a director... Or an editor, kind of this question, I think, you know, where we are kind of all involved in movies in one way, shape, or form. What is it like to edit in 3D and then also kind of with so many visual effects?
Actually, I would say there's not much difference in 3D because I don't cut in 3D. I cut in 2D and then after I've cut the scene together, I'll watch it in 3D and might make some adjustments for frames because your eye takes a little bit longer to go from place to place, and then I put it back to 2D again because it just it's really doesn't really affect me much. Mm-hmm. Now the effects, it makes it much more difficult. I remember on Jack, we had this little cat in the room, you know, and a little cat toy would be in the frame, you know, and I'm like, well, we'll just erase the cat toy, you know. And, oh, no, you can't do that. Like, why? It's just like a simple, oh, no, it's just in 3D. It's way too complicated. I'm like, of course, I've learned a lot since then that I was being a little hosed, okay? Uh-oh. But and I'm like, wow. So we go and reshoot the cat, which is a nightmare, of course, you know, just for those moments where we couldn't take down the stick, you know. Right. Since then, I've learned they were just whining and didn't want to spend the time to put it back, to put it in 2D and then do the effect and put it back in 3D again and convert it, you know. So, but it does make visual effects much more, less easy to do. I mean, there's just a lot more complication.
In cinematography, you know, from what I've learned I worked with the movie My Bloody Valentine.
Yeah, well, we shot all second unit in 2D because I didn't want the second unit guys to have their hands tied behind their back because shooting 3D can be like walking through sand, you know. Yeah. So the stunt scenes or a lot of stuff I'd give second unit was converted, you know. Mm-hmm. Which is another reason I didn't want to cut in 3D because it was just constantly popping between 2 and 3, 2 and 3, you know, until we converted.
Well, this movie looks fantastic in 3D.
I mean, it's like you would never know what was converted and what wasn't. So no. I'm thinking, do we really want to shoot in 3D anymore? It looks great, you know, but just me. I'm sure any 3D person has heard me say that 4 or 5
times. Well, we've talked about this here. Like, you know, 3D has come a long way. And it's, you know, I think it's – I'm hoping that it's slowly gaining – It's ground again because, you know, after movies like Clash of the Titans, which almost killed it, you know, it almost killed 3D. But it's such a great, like you yourself said, I like watching these movies in 3D. Yeah, and I do too. Anything that gets the butts in seats and that gives you a different visceral experience, so long as the movie's good.
Yeah.
Today, the technology and digital technology has made 3D, like now it's sharp. You know, theaters are finally getting on board by putting their light bulbs at that full luminosity so that it shines off screen. And X-Men look fantastic. Dark scenes, light scenes, whatever. Yeah, it's a great way. I think today it's a great way to watch a movie like X-Men. It really rates. So.
I'm curious, what are your favorite scenes in the movie? Or, like, if you had any scenes that were really difficult to edit or that you found challenging? Like, what are your, I don't know.
My favorite scenes are always the character scenes between, I mean, you know, even though we're in the house a long time, it's when Logan is trying to convince a bitter Xavier.
Yeah.
And I love that scene. And it was a little bit longer before, but everyone's like, oh my God, we're in the house for too long. Oh, you know, people are going to run out of the theaters. You know, I'm like, sorry about that. But it's a great scene, you know, and so those are my favorite moments. And the little, nuances the actress will get ad-lib. And McAvoy did some ad-lib in this and that was one little micro battle I lost because there's a couple ad-libs he did which you know the peanut gallery didn't want, so we took them out, but they'll be back in, you know, little extended version to put all those little teeny things back
so we can all see them.
Did you ever have challenges editing, because editors also help with the story making of films? Did you have any challenges with editing any films of your past that you needed another editor to come in and maybe give you suggestions?
I would never do that. No? I mean, I had a junior editor I brought on who he became a partner of mine on this project. But instead of bringing another editor in from another movie to watch, that would be something the studio would want to do. But okay. I wouldn't necessarily. I mean, I have so many people to bounce things off of in the editing room and so forth. And I'm like, what do you think of this? And I mean, I've never done that before, but I don't know.
Yeah. Because we've done some films where that we've discussed before that, like, some editor has had another editor and, like, give their input into films. So I was just wondering if that ever happened.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say if the editor's a friend of mine, I'd bring them in to bounce things off
of. What if someone asked you? What if someone asked you to come in and give
them? No, it's a weird thing. Well, I would come in and give my two cents. It's just very difficult as an editor to come in and watch something because, again, you don't know what's under the hood. Mm-hmm. So all I could do as an editor even is aside from things that are egregiously horribly edited, would be the overall. It would be like, hey, I'm not getting this. This emotionally isn't working. But I mean, I would have to basically, if I came in as an editor to watch a thing, I'd be watching it as a director would watch something and respond. You know,
speaking of under the hood, what are like some of your tricks as an editor sometimes, like to get around certain problems? Like, for example, you know, I'll be where John and I edited our movie, you know, we reuse a lot of shots just to make certain things work at certain times, or, you know, and especially in a time travel movie, there's a lot more leeway with that because sometimes people forget, like, oh, that might have been there. What are some of your techniques?
I mean, it's the techniques are basically just born out of desperation. So I don't know the specific technique, but like you said, I mean, there are shots that were repurposed for different reasons.
Yeah, we've been there.
And those are the parts that are hard for me to watch because I'm seeing it as a Roger Corman moment where I'm like looking at a reaction shot that was for some other scene and then, you know, and even the background was wrong and I'm like, oh, really? You know, so it's those things that when I watch the film drive me crazy, but there's a lot of finagling from.
But I know what, you know, so, you know, it happens out of necessity, and so, you know, at this point, it's no secret that Rogue was basically cut out of, you know, that whole rescue moment, so I imagine a lot of, you know, creative cutting had to happen when that, you know, when you took that out.
Well, it's more like, well, creative cutting, yes, but more like creative pickup shots, because it wasn't, we all know that she was removed from this big rescue sequence, but the thing is, when she was rescued, she came back into that monastery, and she switched places with Kitty. So for the rest of the movie, it's Rogue doing that. Yeah. So to test this idea, first of all, before we went and reshot those little moments, was we did this Roger Rabbit thing where we animated a Kitty on top of Rogue because she used to be the one in that room, and Bobby wasn't there anymore because he died in the rescue sequence. So now I got a problem where I got Bobby. So then we had animated Bobby sitting next to her for the rest of the film just to see how this worked, and we kind of deemed, okay, it works. So now we're going to go surgically shoot any moment where Bobby would be seen or it would be Kitty instead of Rogue, and then so we had to reshoot all those little moments. So it's going to be a mind explosion. People ever see this restored because it's going to be Rogue back at the table, and Kitty is on the floor. She's on the floor the rest of the film. You know?
Minute wise, what did that amount to?
It was probably like maybe not even 9 minutes.
That's a long time. 9 minutes,
that was the main reason that
real.
It wasn't the time. The time wasn't the reason we took it out, because films can be 3 hours and entertaining. Right. It's just that from the realization in 73 that Raven's going to be in Washington and she's probably going to go get Trask there. This was stuck in the middle of that. So by the time we came back to them in Washington, you're like,
Where are we?
What are we doing? Happened? Why are we here? We're on some lawn, and what, you know? So that was the problem. Is it just kept the focus of the mission diluted?
Detoured you.
Do you look as far as editing? I mean, again, we talk a lot about editing, and there is a. I always look at it as, you know, good editor will find a good rhythm to the film. Good, you know, good pacing, rhythm.
Yeah.
Is there a similarity when you're composing as well? Like, you know, a good score has a good rhythm through it, and it could heighten the film just as much as editing.
Yeah.
Is there actually a similarity? Or am
I think the rhythm is internal with me because people are always really surprised to know that when I cut the movie, it's dry. There's no music in the movie at all. Right. Maybe for like one scene or two, because there's a reason for that. First of all, when I'm cutting a scene together for the first time, the propensity is, I'll put music in here, I can really sell it. But the problem is that you're masking you're masking a problem perhaps that could be occurring in the scene, and you're just going to delay the discovery of that till later, and it's going to blow up my face at the time I can't afford for it to blow up my face, so I need to have all problems exposed now. So I, when I get back, I watch the whole thing dry, and if I'm into it and I'm not recognizing egregious, or I've solved the problems already, then when I add the score, it's just going to
heighten
it. And then, so then what I do is after I've assembled the editor's cut, then I do the temp. And so now it's not like this hacked up, cobbled thing over months of cutting up this music that's been in there. And it's so it gives it more of a, like you said, more of a rhythm that's less hacked up, you know.
Have you ever been in a situation, it could have been with X-Men Days of Future Past or any other movie that you've like edited, where you watched it dry and you're like, yeah, that, I call it sort of kind of like the Halloween thing, like where Carpenter showed Halloween without the music and people weren't in suspense at all. They said, what the hell is this? And then when he added score, people were like, wow, that's crazy.
Well,
like, do you ever watch a movie and go, this movie is, oh, it's okay. And then when you do your score, wow, this is amazing.
Well, Valkyrie is an example of that, because Valkyrie, actually, my game plan was not to have, hardly any music in that movie. What are we looking at?
Looking at a time. What was the reason for that? Just because you wanted to...
Well, because I saw it as this, the opportunity, this raw reality thing where you're actually there. And I love doing sound design. I'm very involved in designing the sound of the film because I don't cut to music. So all I have to do is sound design.
Right.
And I really get... sound design is my reward. When I cut a sequence, I get to do all the sound, the ambiences, the computer stuff. I love doing all that stuff. So on Valkyrie, it was all about the teletype machines and the rat-tat-tat and the raw reality of being there in those rooms. And so that's what I really wanted the film to feel like. And it was working, but then you put music in and you're like, whoa. Oh.
Yeah.
You know, and then once you light that fuse, you can't stop it. So it came wall to wall music, but what I did is I buried the score in with the machine, so it became like just a pulse you feel. And I think the on the dub stage, the mixers were surprised about the non-agenda I have with the score I've written, because I was like, no, the intention is to bury that in with the typewriters, you know, have it be just embedded, you know.
Did you find Valkyrie as being a challenge, being, you know, it's based off of two events, and the audience are, you know, if they're educated enough, they know the outcome from the moment that before they buy the ticket. They know how this is going to end.
That's a massive feat because, first of all, you got old men in rooms talking a lot, and yet you got to feel like it's a suspense thriller. But the biggest challenge was, the bomb goes off halfway through the film and it's done, and so you're like, so now you have to keep the audience on their seat after the bomb's gone off to see what the fallout of that's going to be and whether they get away with it or not. And that was a huge challenge musically and editorially.
Yeah, because we know that, again, going into it, we know that he didn't die from a bomb like that, and we know that Tom Cruise is going to die at the end. I mean,
everything that's going to happen. Right. So how do you keep an audience in suspense for an outcome they already know?
Yeah.
And that was a huge, huge challenge. But that's
how did you get around it?
Well, I think the power of the story – it takes a lot of that away. I mean, the story's so good, and because after that bomb goes off, that's where very few people know what the hell went on about trying to take over the government and so forth through basically charades, you know, when the guy is not really dead. And and with music and editing, you know, basically it gets you wrapped up into something and be excited by it. And again, the story was so strong, I thought.
Now you mentioned earlier that you played clarinet and also piano. Are there any other instruments?
No, never played piano.
No,
I wish I'd played the piano.
Oh, you wish. Are there any other instruments that you challenge yourself to incorporate into your writing, your composing?
I don't know if I challenge myself to use some instrument I haven't used before necessarily. I mean, I have my favorite instruments that I use. I mean, it's not too profound. I love the cello because it can do anything. It's from low to high, and it's so expressive. I don't write for much clarinet anymore, especially since woodwinds are kind of out in today's modern film music. You know, you can't use any flutes or clarinets. So, I enjoy writing for doing wild things with instruments that I could never play, because I know those guys out there are going to play it first time through amazingly, and it's sometimes I write something to see if I can slip them up, you know. It's like, and so it's really fun to watch them try to play some of the stuff that I write, you know.
Right, it's great, because my favorite track of this film is the Charles Xavier Hope, because there's beautiful piano chords and all that, and I thought it was beautifully done.
Well, thank you. Yeah.
And I've listened to the soundtrack twice already, and it's so good because you're so good at building the music to this epic music in the end. It's just like every track is a slow build up to something.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I organized the cues right on the album.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that was my favorite theme because it was the first thing I wrote was the Charles theme, because I had to be inspired by something, and I already knew this movie is about this guy. And so that I knew that if I couldn't come up with something for him, I was screwed. So, and then, yeah, it becomes the thread through the movie. Yeah,
it's beautiful.
I know you don't necessarily have the score in mind as you're editing, but do you have like a pinpoint of a specific scene of like, this is where we got to get in a scene, and like that's what scene is held upon?
Oh yeah, cutting a film, I'll create like a pregnant moment to know this is going to be a big dramatic moment for score, and not that I'm trying to accommodate the score, but I know that I'm going to draw things out of it because I'm going to make the scene feel more epic, and it's going to feel slow here a little bit, but I know the music's going to
fill it.
But what that music's going to be.
Like when the stadium's going up, that's just brilliant.
But I also have a tape recorder that I have bobbing all the time. So when I think of something, I whistle it in, and it's always like, you know, the typical thing. You're in the shower and sitting by in the bathroom or by my bedstand, and only because I'm so petrified while we're filming or editing the film that this thing I got to do, which is write the score, I'm so worried about it all the time. So to make myself feel better, I'll just whistle these random things in. And of course, the months later, I'll then refer to them when I'm ready to write. I'm like, what the hell was that? You know, it's like, it's mainly just mainly these awful ideas, but it made me feel better at the time, you know.
So that thing's always looming? Because, you know,
always.
As you're editing, you've always,
no,
oh my
the
God.
Day, when I'm on the plane flying to where we're going to shoot, I'm worried about it. Because I don't know how I'm going to do it. Because, the film management never stops. Mm-hmm. So it's not like I can go, okay, well, I'm going to go write the score now, stop everything, you know. There's, you've got test screenings, you've got visual effects issues, you've got ADR, the actors, you're constantly, especially with a film like this, you're kind of reorganizing things, and that never stops. So then they end up putting an Avid in my bedroom upstairs, so to lessen the number of times I have to drive to the editing room, and so I'll be upstairs dealing with cuts and running downstairs and writing, and
You mentioned test screening. Have you ever snuck into one as to listen to some of these people? I mean, there's been much said about test screenings. Some people like thought that they hate it, they love it. There was a great little documentary on the Final Destination DVD about test screening.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, and about the whole process and how like the directors had to sit through this. Have you ever sat in during a test screening?
Every time.
And every time you sit back, like, and do you, some of them, sometimes somebody can come up with something.
Yeah, well, there can
cool,
be,
and then other people like,
well, there could be a whole movie made about test screenings.
Yeah.
It'd be surreal because, yeah, I mean, I think test screenings are great for, to see how, if everyone's universally confused by something, it was worth testing the film to know that. Or if they're universally not laughing at a joke, that's fine. But test screenings basically get abused. And so, and they get abused by the producers and people on the film.
Yeah.
Because everyone has their idea of what they want to put, and so they'll wait for those three comments out of 100, and then say, well, clearly everyone thought this because they said that. And then they'll manipulate the cards, and they'll have their own private analysis done to accommodate their agenda. And this becomes just an awful, awful experience, you know, and you really got to take people, you got to not believe what people are telling you, the people with the agendas, you know,
and
keep things in perspective.
My favorite at a test screening is, you know, they, oh, did everybody really like the movie? And about 100 hands come up or whatever, or you got your focus group. And then they proceed to trash the movie after they've already said that they liked it. Wait a minute. So when you, how much of it do you take? How much of it do you take with a grain of salt? And then how did you go, well, that person actually is onto something? And
yeah, I mean, again, I think if there's just something that a majority of people are responding to, I'm going to take that seriously. But when it becomes like three or four people,
completely subjective, and it's like,
You know. But having said that, one person could have an idea that I'm like, hey, that's a pretty good idea. So, I mean, it's or like any idiot. My mother can walk into the editing room and go, yeah, what if we do that? I'm like, well, that's a good idea, even though 90% of the other things she said will be ridiculous, you know. And, you know, and so you'll have these people that you're working with on the movie, and whether it's executive producers or so forth, and, you know, and a bunch of their ideas might be idiotic, but they'll say one thing and you're like, oh, that's right. That's a good idea. But of course, then of course, unfortunately, that authorizes them to
give you all the other ideas.
Yeah, you know, or yeah. You know.
Okay, so for X-Men's test screenings, was there anything that you were surprised about that people were really in love with, or people were confused by?
Well, I wouldn't say we were surprised by the Quicksilver sequence, but we were
pleasantly like.
Well, yeah, I guess we were kind of surprised. I mean, not that we liked it ourselves, so it's not like we're surprised people liked it. I guess we're surprised at the degree of which people liked it, and actually him as a character, because we were really paranoid about that guy. When in the first scene in the basement where they come down and meet him, we reshot that. There was an original scene that we shot, which no one will ever see because it was bad. Because we're trying to find him, you know, as a character. Simon was writing wise, and so then. Came up with a whole different dialogue for him that made him cooler, and reshot it so we could be introduced to this character and he's like a cooler guy. But what was the question again? Oh, things I was surprised by.
Yeah. Surprised. People were confused, but I mean, I think the Quicksilver one, I was expecting in a way.
I understood Quicksilver's because he's such a fast guy. He's doing a million things literally all at once. Yeah. So I kind of saw that he might have been a guy like ADHD kind of personality because he's doing a million things.
Right.
But I could understand his humor and his character. That stood out well.
How many times did they test screen? How many times did they test screen?
He must have done it like 12 times or something.
12 times for this song.
But it's just internal. It's you make some changes and then let's watch it again. Mm-hmm. Let's watch it again. Let's watch it again. So after like the 12th time, you're like, you know, it's feeling along now. Like, no kidding, you've seen it 12 times.
But how about in front of a live studio audience?
We almost did that.
Yeah.
And at the last second, so I was against it because I'm like, really? We're going to have... We're trying to keep all this stuff under wraps, and you're really going to think we're going to bring an outside audience in here? None of it's going to get out.
Yeah.
And but no, they powers that be, whoever wanted to do it. So no, not blaming. It was just there's no particular person, but it was decided to do it.
Yeah.
And the audience is gathering. They're all in the theater. They're waiting, and suddenly we see on the internet people are saying, "I'm going to go see X-Men tonight." On the Twitters and so forth. And so I went up to Brian. I go, I just want you to know that three people already are saying they're about to see this movie. And he's like, shut it down. So we claimed a technical error.
Right.
And I felt bad for all those people, but they could wait for like an hour in there.
Yeah.
Because I know Famke Janssen in particular was...
Well, we had taken that out.
Of the test screening?
Yeah. Even in the internal test screenings, because we had some friends and family coming, we took that out. So basically, he walks in, he looks at the office, then he sees Xavier. So we didn't have that in ever, you know,
wow.
screenings. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Jennifer Lawrence's character, Raven, because, you know, it would have been so easy to make her kind of like a MacGuffin. Mm-hmm. Where she's just like, okay, here's this person we got to go for. But obviously, you know, she's such a great actress, and everyone's loved. You know, how's finding the balance for her? And you know, I saw you had an ArcLight interview, and you kind of confirmed that she is like America's sweetheart. She really is who she is.
Well, we put together the assistants in the editing room put together like a 10-minute Jennifer Lawrence reel. It was done to Sexy Lady, and it was all the outtakes of her and how irreverent and crazy she is. And I'm like. If I were her agent or manager, I would demand everyone in the universe saw this thing because you just fall in love with her because you get to see her as she really is, which is exactly that, just down-to-earth, irreverent, crazy, hilarious person. You know, and we had to cut it down because she got a little rank in a lot of the, you know, things and mooning the camera and stuff like, you know, with her blue suit on, you're like, whoa. But so we cut it down to like 3 minutes, so that'll be on the DVD. But, nice. But you know, she's really – I mean, we had a really tough moment in the movie where – she has to make this decision with this gun.
Right.
And which in the old storyline, we basically back engineered months later the storyline to accommodate the fact that she can't kill the guy. Because the original storyline was she just can't get caught by him. And right. So her character the entire movie is hunting down this guy who's killed her friends. And I saw this coming like a million miles away, but so we go to shoot the scene with 400 extras out there, and she's got that moment, and she's like, why wouldn't I shoot him? Wait a minute. I have been hunting this guy down. I would blow his brains out, you know, or I would shoot myself. Because the old storyline was simply, She gets in his clutches, and they design the Sentinels of the Future based upon her mutation. Simple. But the problem is that moment becomes you can't sell that moment. So we had to back engineer the story where she can't shoot the guy because by shooting him, she changed the future in a bad way. So that's where we had to change it. But at that point, the script was different. And so then we had this complete meltdown. She's like, you know, I feel terrible. You know, I really feel bad. But, you know, she goes, I barely graduated. I didn't go to college or something, she says. You know, she goes, but I know that I would never do this, you know. And so I'm like, gosh, she really, you know, she's not just doing this for a paycheck. She understands her character. So then, but then became the big, I called it the $350,000 or $400,000 writing meeting we had because we're sitting there on our shooting day with all those extras sitting there. We're figuring this out. Wow. So we huddled, and McAvoy's like having this debate with her saying, well, if you don't shoot him, my character is a disaster because my whole character arc is to get you to not to do that, you know. He goes, yeah, but I wouldn't do it. So it became this back and forth. And finally, before we had even months later back engineered the story, we made her do it. She's all do it, so she did it. And then we did a alternate version where she blows him away, mm-hmm. Which was cool and shocking, but then you can't have the future become what it became. And so we did both versions, and then for months we just struggled with how do we make this moment where the whole movie's headed to make some sort of sense. So,
hey, Marissa, speaking of time travel, she and I were having a conversation just before you came regarding timeline. And with you being here, maybe you have some insights on certain things.
My particular question, because from the X-Men Last Stand, we see Jean Grey kills Xavier and disintegrates his body.
Oh, yeah, well,
and
whatever.
Consciousness still survives, but his body is still there in the future. And I was just wondering how that, like, incorporates and how does Xavier's body still exists in the future.
I don't think any of us know that. I think we have to take him for his word. That line he has in the end of Wolverine.
There's like speculation.
Where he says we all have certain gifts or whatever he says. I'm like, hey, good enough for me. Because I don't think it's so like something you can't solve that we just sort of like let, like, you don't answer the question. Because, you know, you got to have him back but everything else, I mean, the erasure of what happened in X3 makes sense now because the timeline's changed, you know, all of what they did in Star Trek and so forth, which of course still drives me crazy. like, how could there not be a Vulcan and Spock's mother be dead or...
I'm not complaining that either because my favorite characters came back. I'm happy.
I mean, literally no one has an answer to that.
How about the Adamantium? The last time we saw Wolverine last summer, you know, he was back to his old bones and skeletal structure as his claws. And now in this one, when we see him, he's got his adamantium back. Was there anything that was cut out
we talked about it and we're like, well, you know, who knows what happened in the last 50 years or whatever, you know, maybe Magneto helped him out or something. I mean, I don't know, but something happened where we got his adamantium back.
Now, did you choose in that scene, did you choose the Star Trek episode Naked Time?
I made a fan out of our apprentice editor because I said, okay, there is a Star Trek episode where Kirk says we're going backward in time.
Yep.
And I don't know I forgot Naked Time was the name of the episode. He found it, he goes, it's Naked Time. He goes, that's right. And I go, watch the episode. So he watched, he goes, oh, it's really cool. I go, well, let me give you a few more you can watch. So then he watched more episodes. And then he says, I realized he had never seen Star Trek 2. And I'm like, what?
Oh my
God. So he, you know, I said, you know, you're horrified when people haven't seen that film. And so he watched it and he goes, yeah, I loved it. So, because Star Trek 2 is sort of the template for Brian and me for anything we were
watching. Well, it was a template for X2, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I brought that up last week.
It's a source of inspiration.
Ralph Winter was the producer of.
That's a coincidence, but it's just a well written character movie.
Yeah.
And it's got such romance to it. So we just went to that what would Jesus do? It's like, what would Star Trek 2 have done? You know, and that was a lot of inspiration for that film. Yeah.
That's great. Because as soon as, like, I saw Star Trek pops up, I said, oh, you know, I was with my friends. And I'm like, all right, you know that I'm loving this movie, like, that much more now.
Yeah.
And I go, of course there's a Star Trek reference. It's a time movie.
Yeah,
like,
that's
awesome.
That episode just popped into my head right away. I'm like, you know, because I, you know, those lines, you just know.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Great stuff.
But we had to re-edit the episode in the background because...
So I have one other question. So back in the public access days, when this was filming that, and this is how this was sort of a trial by fire for you, where you were thrown into doing editing and composing.
Right.
Do you ever look back at those days now and go, what the hell was I thinking? Because now I'm locked into whenever I work with this guy, he's going to make me do this.
Yeah, I never would have known the blackmail would have come to this day. But, I came in late to Public Access. He had shot the whole thing, and it was cut by another editor. And then he basically came to my camped out outside my house one night. And I said, I'm 2 blocks away. I got to talk to you. So he came and basically threatens me. He'll tell the same story, you know, and say basically, you're never going to work in this town ever unless you recut my movie. And so I said, all right, I don't want to see what the original was, and just take it apart and let me start over. So I started over, and I had a full-time job, which is the whole reason I couldn't do the film in the first place, because the producers wouldn't let me edit a feature and work. Because there was no money. So anyway, so I did it, and then the composer fell out in the last moment, and we had a Sundance deadline. So I had been doing the music as a hobby, and I said, I know this character really well. I should score the film. Right. And he was like, all right. So
you blackmailed him on that.
Oh, my one and only time. Yeah. So then people had singled out the score and the music. And so then we put the Usual Suspects together. I'm like, great. Can't wait to score that movie. He goes, you're going to cut the film too. And then, basically, this is what happens to
me. Who is the name of this little composer that decides to kick the project to the curb back then?
No, it wasn't his decision. It just wasn't working. The music was very sinister, mm-hmm. one-dimensional sinister, right. Where there's more to a bad character.
Okay.
They're bad for a reason. There's something horrible in their past. And so I always try to bring in some romance to a bad character like Kaiser Soze.
That's
so reluctant editor. So just because it's such a laborious process?
Well, first of all, it's the worst punishment you can put a human being through.
That's true. I will
attest to this. But it's also... I could write 3 or 4 film scores in the time it takes me to edit one movie, and I can walk up, I could wake up in my bathrobe, and I could go to my keyboard and work for some hours. I can actually have a life, go to a dinner, and then I have a break after 2 or 3 months. I can make residuals, which editors don't make for some crazy reason. So, there's a financial loss, actually, believe it or not, to go and edit a movie because I do have a scoring career.
Right.
I always say, in the old days, it used to be the composer would walk in the room and, the angels would sing. It's like, oh my God, it's the composer, and I lived in some of those days. But then the last 10 years or so, you're like as good as craft service, because producers are thinking, well, my neighbor's kid has GarageBand and anybody can do this thing. And so you kind of, I feel like a grunt sometimes when I'm just a composer for hire. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I'm not able to have I'm impacting the movie's composer, but I'm not helping make it. And so despite my complaints, I do get that need to be in control of the project. Which is great for 2 months, and I'm over it. Then I got about 12 to go.
So it's over a year for the editing process for you.
This movie was very accelerated. It was almost TV schedule, because we were supposed to come out when Planet of the Apes came out, and they flipped us. So we suddenly lost 3 months off our schedule. So we were very accelerated. But so it would have been over a year, but it was about a year on this one. Jack was 2 solid years of editing designing and. Because it was very
effects,
very motion capture stuff.
And your scoring takes 2 to 3 months. Is that what you're saying?
If I'm just right, if I'm just on as a composer, it can be anywhere from 3 or 4 weeks to 2 or 3 months. This one I spread out my writing schedule because I'm going to be so interrupted all the time. Mm-hmm. So.
You've directed as well. It was a Urban Legends Final Cut. I believe. Okay. Are you ever going to ever direct again? Did you like that experience?
I loved it.
It was a horror movie.
I loved it. I mean, I wouldn't normally do a horror movie. I remember being offered that film, which I wasn't even looking to direct, because your life is funny that way. You go in intending to do one thing, and you end up doing something else. And then someone asks you to do that thing you went in for originally. You want me to direct a movie? And I'm like, well, cool. What is it? And they told me, and I'm like, oh, it's like when your grandmother gives you the polka dotted socks. You're like, oh, awesome, But I embraced it, and for what it was, it was number one at the box office and so forth, and that was my crossroads. It's like I was offered all these teen movies, and I'm like, I don't want to be doing teen movies. And then, and I felt like the scoring community had written me off, like, you're not one of us anymore. And and I got kind of like, I was weirded out by that. And so I went back into the film scoring thing, and who knows what was the right decision, you know. But
ever have any desire to do it again?
And I would love to do it again. And the problem, because just to get out of the room, you know, and see people, and I loved working with actors, and I really loved the process of it. The problem is when I get in that mindset, I'm like, I'm going to go do something like that. It takes development time, and I'm going down this road. I'm getting things, something going. And then Brian comes along, hey, I got a big carrot for you to score a big movie, you know. And so I'm like, oh, okay, you know. So, but so it's really my issue about having just to say no to something once in a while and just going off and doing something on my own.
Speaking of being stuck in a room, this happened to me when I used to edit, where like you get to know the people on screen so well that when you meet them, you're like, oh, I know you. And they're like, who are you? Has that ever happened to you? Just
well, you know, what's funny is that when I was writing the score, you know, I'd go to bed at 2 or 3 in the morning, and to wind down, I'd just turn on the TV, and it was Star Trek: The Next Generation. We'd play in a loop on BBC America, you know. And so this happened like 3 or 4 months while I'm, you know, writing. And even though I was already working with Patrick as Xavier on our real shoot, and we went back for the reshoots, now I've sort of, he's fresh in my mind, and I realize how that show would have collapsed without that guy. And he's everything about that show. And so it was weird. I was starstruck again, you know. And so I'd be like, work with him thinking, oh my God, I'm working with Patrick, with
Jean-Luc Picard.
With Picard, you know. And so it was weird, you know, just because I'd been watching that for so many months. And then, I remember I had to take him, the poor guy was doing Waiting for Godot, and then we flew him to Montreal, and we had to get all of this stuff done in one day. So it was like, okay, go over here on this set. Okay, come over here and get to this green screen. Okay, come over here and do this. You know, this, you know, he's like 72 years old. Like, come on, you know. So then I had to get some ADR lines with him for a screening that was going to come up. We didn't have time to bring it in for ADR.
Oh, wow.
So I needed to get some temp stuff. So I ran him over to the cafeteria, closed the doors, and then the microphone, you know, he could have easily gotten really cranky, but he was getting a little perturbed by everything he had to go through, and he was tired, but still, it's just a great guy, you know.
Yeah. He's Captain Picard.
Yeah, yeah. But when you start seeing the crankiness come a little bit, you're like, oh, I don't want to see this. I don't want to see this side of this, of, you know, because it makes him like not Captain Picard anymore.
Has there ever been an actor, this could be a tricky question, but has there ever been an actor?
A nameless actor. You don't have to name
it. I want a name. Yeah. Like that has, like, you know, I think perhaps we've all had an experience where we really appreciate and respect somebody, and we're like, wow, this, you know, and then you meet the person, and the person's an a-hole on set throughout the entire thing, and...
Yeah. If I had some real story knowing me, I'd just tell it, but it actually hasn't happened for me.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Yeah, no.
The friendship between between Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart.
That's awesome, because we had this kickoff dinner before the movie started. It was everyone back again at this giant dinner we had, and you know, all the actors from X-Men 2, and then they're sitting together, and first of all, we're all saying, oh God, no one's changed a bit, you know, and first then you go look at a picture of yourself, like yeah, we have, but it's so cool to hear them just banter with each other and laugh like they're good old friends, and it was odd because it's like, not only am I watching Patrick Stewart and Ian McKellen, I'm watching Magneto and Xavier, who are also sort of these pals but on different sides, you know, and it's sort of like strange. It was just cool to watch them reminisce, and you know, because they go way back to acting school or something like that, and Patrick was always upset that Ian was getting the parts, and you know, and he claims this bitterness to this day that, you know, he got to be Gandalf and not him, you know, and so it's very funny, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Marissa, you were
I was just going to say, you've done a lot of, going back to the composing and music, you've done a lot of film, but have you ever considered, you know, composing music for video games? Whoa, hello. like video games, like the next, you know, Halo series.
Well, you know, I started doing a video game. It was for Spider-Man, and I was a third the way into it, and then they scrapped the movie. It was for the movie that they were going to be shooting, and then they canceled it. And so that was my foray into video games.
Speaking of Spider-Man, did you have any creative input into what scene was going to be used at the end of Amazing Spider-Man 2? Because promotional purposes, no.
When we put the fight scene in there, the teaser.
Now you guys remember.
Yeah, I was like,
making me feel
because I was just horrified. Period. That we'd put some sort of hacked up scene at the end of any movie from our film, like, ugh, you know. So I was like, whatever. I didn't want to even hear about it. You know, don't even show it to me. You know. So yeah, no.
How about the button at the end of this movie going into Apocalypse?
Yeah, like, what the hell is that?
Yeah. You
know, I mean, that, okay, now, I don't care how many people are understanding the film as non-fans, but you got to see that as a non-fan and go, what in the world did I just look at? But it's such a fan thing, so I think it was embraced by the fans because they get it. You know, they can explain to their friends, oh, this is the Four Horsemen. Blah,
blah, I was freaking out.
But were you really?
That's Steven in the booth.
Oh, okay, really? All right, great.
Marissa can attest to it.
Because, yes. I mean, I'm an X-Men fan, but not that deep, so I didn't know even who Apocalypse was. And I'm like, okay, you know. And that was done really at the last nanosecond. The effects team had, like, no time to think about what it was going to be.
Right.
Because all we knew is we need a tag with Apocalypse. What's that going to be? And so
right.
We got the previous guys on. They just thought, what if this guy is doing this thing? You know, so we're like, okay, you know. And just to get that put together, I don't know how they did it so fast with all the animated people.
If this is common knowledge, I apologize as to the group, but have they already approached you for Apocalypse? Are you guys on board with this?
I mean, you know, it's sort of – I'm sort of a part of the Brian formula, but okay. There's not any sort of we're going to make a deal, so,
right.
You know.
Other questions you guys have? I know we got to wrap you out soon, which, by the way, Sarah, do you want to ask any? You've been kind of quiet for a little bit.
I've just been listening, absorbing, doing all this stuff. No, but I think it's so fascinating to me, composing, because it's something I was involved in music, but I cannot wrap my mind around how you create this, like, new individual score, because for me, whenever I'm thinking about music, I always get inspired by other songs, by other movies. So how do you keep it, like, fresh and that you're not pulling from other people and keep your mind, like, open, like a blank slate?
I think every composer said that, you know, the fear is every time you start a film, it's the one you're not going to be able to think of anything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Danny Elfman says that. It's something like his analogy where you go down to the well and then there's nothing there this time. But I don't know. It's just out of sheer panic, something comes because it has to. And I live based upon a calendar on the wall and a recording date. And I'm like, okay, today I have to. I'm screwed if I don't write something. I don't know what it is. I mean, it's like, I guess because there's so many things in your head that you, like, when you have a dream, it's all based upon shit that's in your head.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing when you're writing something. When I see something in my head pops related to something that's already in there, and it gets rejiggered around and comes out in some other way, you know. And then also when you're temporarily putting the music in the movie, that sort of becomes a roadmap or a guide.
Yeah. How much do you write that doesn't get included? Like, how many, like, you worked on Xavier's themes, like, how many versions
iterations,
of that
yeah,
are there? Like,
yeah, well, there's lots of iterations that privately I just throw in the trash or put delete, control X or whatever it is, control Z, you know, control X. And so there's probably countless versions of stuff that I don't like, or I'll come back the next morning and go, that's crap, or, you know, and so, but, in terms of actually, something that was written and recorded, you know, there's not a huge amount of stuff, but there's probably a good, 6 or 7 minutes on this movie that I did as alternate versions of things, well, there's probably more considering that one scene that was redone. That's 5. So maybe like 10 minutes of music here that we did as alternate. I did as alternate ideas just to cover my ass.
Mm-hmm.
Is there another X-Men character that you would love to compose a theme for?
I'm ashamed to say that I'm only a fan of the X-Men characters that are in the movie I'm working on. So I don't know the franchise enough, or I don't read the comic books to know what these other. All I know is, you know, they've already said that Gambit is going to be in the next movie, and I've never heard the end of Gambit, 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 Gambit. We're making X-Men 2. Got to have Gambit, Gambit. It's like people are always talking about this guy Gambit. So I guess, you know, if he has a major storyline, maybe he'll have his own theme. I have no idea, you know.
Very cool. Well, thank you for joining us, John. Yeah. It's been a pleasure. You mentioned earlier that your website, you want to give it a quick plug?
Oh,
it's a great website.
I'm not sure I want to. It's not quite done yet, but it's john@johnottman.com. I try to sort of, on every page, remember my experiences and then give the G-rated or, you know, the version I can actually tell as a sort of memory of my experience. And I put photos and everything, but I've been delinquent on the last few projects, but I'll try to get around to them.
Yeah. No, it's a great website. Well, one silly question. I purchase a lot of soundtracks. Mm. Many of them, a majority of them. Well, why aren't the music tracks in order of appearance in the movie?
Well,
like what?
Because you know,
how does that happen?
Fucking boring, you know. Because you know, a lot of times if it's a movie order, it's every cue. It's not a listening experience that'll
gotcha.
That'll be interesting, you know. And then that's why a lot of stuff is cut out. I mean, there's a 115 minutes I did for this movie, and it's a long album. It's like 70 something minutes on there, but there's about 36 minutes missing on the album. Which brings me to the whole another soapbox issue. I don't get that.
Fair enough.
People basically judge a score on an album based upon the album. Huh? And this score sucks. This score is good. Based upon what? An album you're listening to? How do you know if it even works in the movie or not?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I've heard lots of fun music on albums and I watch the film like, oh, this is terrible.
See,
you know, so
yeah, it's so
it's
wow,
a really irks thing when people review the score. Review the album. Okay, as an album, this sucks, or this is good, but don't review the score until you see the movie. In fact, I was really hoping this CD was going to be delayed so that people could only hear it after they saw the film, because then they're relating to what helped.
It's rare that I do it, but I did pre-purchase this prior to the movie. We knew you were coming in, but no, to me, I will see the movie if the music is fascinating and interesting to me and it tells the story. That's when I get the soundtrack so I can revisit the movie again, because the music to me tells the story.
Yeah.
And it's on many occasions you'll find me, I can be on my balcony having a nice fine glass of scotch and a cigar listening to a soundtrack and reliving the movie again in the moment. So,
I think it's a fringe benefit if the score alone is fun to listen to without the film, but the job for me is to make the film work.
Right.
And if the most profound thing in the world is like a wah, 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 and it worked great in the movie, that's what I'm going to do.
Wow. Can I ask one question? Sorry. Voice from the booth. Are there any like scores that you've heard that if I played it for you right now, you would just go back to that time when you first saw that scene? Like for me, I would say Unbreakable, I see the pool scene with the music in that movie. Like what's like your favorite go back to nostalgic moment song?
Oh boy!
Or your top three? What comes to mind? Just whatever comes to mind.
For some reason, what pops into my head, which is not a very good example, is the Jawas music in Star Wars. You know, I don't know why. It's like that little scene. It's like this really. It's this piece of music, which John Williams is brilliant at. It's a piece of music, and yet it's underscoring a moment.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Hootie.
What quick advice would you give to anyone who wants to be a film composer? Just real quickly, what would you tell them?
Don't.
Aside from that. The advice I give is actually really sounds lame, but it's true because people don't really. It's basically I always get it's for anything, not just music. It's basically do. It's because the lamest, dumbest project you get could be the one that leads you somewhere where you least expect, and it also teaches you to have a good attitude about the things you work on. Because even to this day, I'll get some shitty film, and I have to delude myself that it's going to be a great movie when I'm done with it, and only until I see it on TV 2 years later I realize it did suck. But I think that if you have that attitude early on, it's going to help you not only stay that way as you work, but the more things you do, and as life is, you end up doing what you least expect.
All right, so Steven,
leave it on that.
Steven, keep the music going. I'll get the camera. Why don't we take a quick photo, let you on out of here, and then we'll give our final thoughts on X-Men Days of Future Past.
Thank you. Boy, that film sucked. I'm glad he's gone.
Now we can really talk about the film. Thank you.
Steven, get the camera. We're going to take a photo. We're going to keep the podcast going. Keep that music going. Lower our mics. Let the fans enjoy the score of John Ottman.
Oh, man.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, for...
That was a great time to have John back in there. That was terrific. I'm glad he came. I'm so appreciative. It was great insight.
He's wonderful, though. Yeah. He also so talked about, obviously. I didn't realize how ingrained he was in, like, the Bryan Singer partnership. I know they worked together for so long, but he really does have a lot of creative input.
Yeah.
And
you have to... What he said was so true. When as an editor, you're in that room, and so you're giving your director your life. So
it
you know
is,
what,
yeah.
Brian better be appreciative.
Better, yeah, exactly.
We lost Dimitri for a moment. We lost Sarah for a moment as they walk out. John for
Marissa, Sarah's here.
I'm here.
That's right.
I can leave.
They're escorting John out.
We won't go too much longer. Obviously, we've talked about amazing stuff, but we just want to kind of talk about some other stuff that perhaps we didn't necessarily hit while we had John, because I mean his stories.
Yeah,
were
I'm just
amazing.
So impressed with the volume of work he does doing both of those duties, editing and composing. It's just crazy.
The amount of time and dedication to a project. But it turned out incredibly well.
Yeah.
I think overall, I'm an X-Men fan. I'm not like a crazy X-Men fan to the point that I the end scene didn't make complete sense to me. I had to look things up. But I watched
the apocalypse.
Yeah, I'm not as knowledgeable to know that.
Right.
But I've watched all the movies many times. And I think that this one really lived up to the standard X-Men has. I think that balancing all of the very powerful and dynamic actors is a huge challenge that they did very well. And that's difficult. Like, so many people were like, oh, well, now this is going to be Jennifer Lawrence's movie. Mm-hmm. And how they really did... Like, they focus on Wolverine. They did use
they
Mystique,
had great balance.
But then they also did the two versions of Xavier and Professor X. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the character use of almost all of them was done really, really well.
Yeah, and you know, the original story of the comics was written by John Byrne and Chris Claremont. Mm-hmm. And Chris, in particular, was a very big story consultant for this movie. Mm-hmm. And I mean, obviously, John kind of talked about all the rewrites and things of that nature and all the different consultants on it. Yeah. And when you talk about a universe like this, you have to have as many good people thinking about it.
What I loved so much about this was, unlike the other movies that we've seen, meaning, Spider-Man 2, first of all, they took the time to do those character beats, they had a much richer plot, character development, arc, all that kind of stuff going in. So it made it way more than just...
Let me ask you this, in terms of that, I know with Amazing Spider-Man in particular, we talked about Jamie Foxx's character, and this, they've really made Peter Dinklage's Trask character the main villain, the focus.
Right.
And how did you guys, did you guys feel that even he, to me, he felt very fleshed out?
He did, but but you also had all these opponent allies. Let's face it, Magneto is a great opponent ally because he's an ally.
That's the sound. Sorry, John. That's the sounds of Dimitri coming back.
Yes,
for
hi,
those
Dimitri,
of you,
welcome back.
Yeah, thanks.
So even though Peter Dinklage's character Trask was obviously the villain in this and the one the major story with Raven, anyways, that she wants to kill him. You also had the other part of this, which is the internal fight between the X-Men, which is the ongoing battle that they always have. So you can maintain that antagonism and have that conflict be part of the narrative, which I thought was great.
Well, to me, to speak for Peter Dinklage and for that character, what I find so fascinating is that they can revisit any character in this in the next one, and it will still, I still feel like there's more. Like, a lot of times I feel like you see a superhero movie and there's a villain, and you really can only see them in that one movie. Mm-hmm. Like, they have their arc is going to be complete. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nothing more. For Peter Dinklage, he could come back. I could see what he would do.
Striker. So how many times does
classic,
he keep coming back?
Exactly.
As a different actor.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they flesh out their character so much that they have a life, and it's not just this one chapter that they're involved in. Like, you can revisit, you can intertwine, because all of the actors take so much on.
Well, speaking of there was a deviation from the comic books, because it was originally supposed to be Senator Robert Kelly, but as we know, that's X1, X2 territory.
Yeah, but I just love how... let's see. We're not going to deal with Xavier being torn to shreds. We're just going to...
What I will give out is that, I feel like a lot of fans are willing to stretch it for them.
Forgive
like,
that.
Yeah, yeah, and they are willing to say, like, oh, well, maybe if X or X, like, went in his twin brother's body's conscious.
Well, I thought for sure, because they had the whole thing with the McAvoy Xavier being able to walk, and that's because he's got the serum, the beast put together, you know, it takes away his powers, but it allows him to, you know, overcome the, injury that he has. I thought they answered that really nicely, and I'm going, oh, good, then they're going to have... I figured they would answer the other one, because I go, okay, how is he part of this? Did I miss a movie? How did Xavier live?
The other crazy thing that happens, though, at the end is with Stryker, who is
Mystique.
Mystique. Mm-hmm. You know, it's clearly... And that changes everything, too, because he's not being captured by Stryker, and he's not... You know, the whole Stryker involvement is about him getting his adamantium blades, and he's test. And now we found out that that's Mystique, and that really, that changes a lot as well. It's just crazy, but we buy it. I don't know what it's going to do in the future movies, and how does Stryker continue to be involved?
But does it? Did it bother anybody else? I mean, you were kind of obviously you were a little bit, but Marissa more so, I would guess that the, you know, Xavier's torn to shreds, and all of a sudden he's back and completely intact, and there's no specific.
I just questioned it because I was a big fan of the X-Men Last Stand, and then a lot of things happen in that film, and everyone who's going to watch this film is going to go back to those and watch that and have those same questions. And we know from the end of X-Men Last Stand, his consciousness, Xavier's consciousness, still survives.
Consciousness,
yeah, but how does
his body.
The body...
There's a few theories from the comic books and from the fans putting together. One of them is that they tease it in Last Stand, where he says that your consciousness can still survive and inhabit another body, and
inhabit
another body. And
but his body was destroyed. That
but
was
there's
amazing.
there is hints to things in the comic books that Xavier has a twin brother who is comatose. And his consciousness entered his comatose twin brother's body. But there's also things.
Body also.
That's the thing. They're like, why is he paralyzed still? Is kind of the question.
And I was trying to, and I apologize for that sound mishap on my part. But there is an article that talks about all the different things and how it affects. And one thing it says is Days of Future Past wiped the X-Men series almost like a blank slate.
Yeah.
What did happen in those first three movies? Clearly, the Phoenix Force did not. Sees Jean as it did in the third film. And I think everything really sort of kind of gravitates to that third film.
Yeah.
And we talked about it even before doing this, that part of the reason, part of the plot line in this was to retcon that third film completely.
Yeah, to erase
it from the history. And again, one of the things it just says here, you know, it's also unclear as to whether Stryker, the antagonist in the second film, is even a factor in the modern day. Is this even a world that hates and fears mutants at all? Is Magneto still a threat? Is he still alive? I mean, it does a lot of things.
Erases everything, and that's honestly fine with. I still have the movies to enjoy for when I want to enjoy them, and just gives more opportunity.
Yeah.
So it doesn't bother me too much.
Yeah, it doesn't bother me. It didn't bother me. You know, Marissa and I had a really heavy conversation about these things, and I get it if you're a fan, but to me, I was like, so long as anything that retcons that third movie, I'm like, I'm happy with. I'll just buy.
Jean
I'll just
Grey
buy
is
into
alive.
It.
I'm happy.
Oh yeah.
Well, but I really like the theory that Magneto is the one to bond the adamantium to Wolverine. Now, I love that theory because I think that as them teaming up, because Wolverine's always kind of been a chaotic, neutral character, that would be amazing. And then I like also, since this wipes the slate clean for Wolverine origins, Deadpool has a chance to have his own movie now without having to have that weighed against him.
Okay. You're talking about the Wolverine origins.
Gambit's going to come first, though.
Yeah, but Deadpool's a huge Marvel character that they kind of ruined with that movie. So giving the option for that is amazing.
And they're also saying that this movie sort of kind of retconned the origins Wolverine movie, not necessarily the last Wolverine movie.
I mean, here's ultimately, right, Hank McCoy has that line about, you know, you throw a stone in the water, but the current eventually is still going to take. So I think what it does nicely is it fixes the old problems, but you can still have it where certain things still continue and kind of
reemerge.
Reemerge, yeah.
Yes.
I kind of saw it like history repeating itself as well, because especially during the whole fight sequences near the end, where they're fighting in the future and they're fighting in the past, but it shows that even though you're going back to the past to righting the wrongs in the future, history still repeats itself. It is a cyclical thing.
But I mean,
they just created more opportunity for themselves, and that's to me the bottom line. Is that they just created space to keep living these stories and to expand.
The other thing that I was thinking is you've just created this idea that you can send people back in time 40 years or whatever. Really? So let's send them back even farther to right a few more wrongs. Are you going to do that? Because you've opened up that vortex.
Right.
Now you can't do that.
That is true.
I mean, if you have the ability to do that, why don't you write more wrongs?
There are a few other story arcs that involve that. Just heads up.
There you go.
Yeah, and that would be, as far as cinematic, like, if from a movie standpoint, how many times do you want to go back to that?
I know, I don't think you would, but I mean, you just open that up, and then every time you don't
but
do
you
it,
did only say, open up through like basically one mutant. Like, they have to establish her again and I guess wait for her to be born, because if you're talking about Kitty and like how she can transport someone's consciousness, she's pictured as a young girl at the
She's talking about basically that
plot line. You have to have Kitty. She has to exist. She has to be
part. Doesn't she already? I mean, she does.
No, but you
but
can't.
But not where we've like
you can't
basically backed up to.
She's not existent in that time period?
No, she is. But I mean, I'm talking about how they've created this window.
This is why the whack-a-mole theory comes in. It's like, right. What the hell are you talking?
Well, I'm surprised. Like, it's great that they got to get Cameron involved, or going to him is great. One question that I was remiss that I didn't get to ask is, did anybody think of contacting Bob Gale and Robert Zemeckis, or did you have the Back to the Future script going on? It's tough when you do a time travel movie. We've talked about it here, and there are rules, and I think where this movie succeeds is it puts the concept out there and it makes it understandable. And it sets up its own rules, and it tells you them from great exposition, and it tells you this is how we can do this, and this is what's going to happen, and they don't fall into time continuum kind of paradox. It's great to have Xavier talk to Xavier, but they do it in a way that they're not occupying the same space. Mm-hmm. And so that's where I thought that this movie was so clever in handling its time travel thing is.
And they did set up rules. Like, absolutely. It had to be, I mean, they made it so it had to be Wolverine.
Yep.
And he's the only one who can survive this. Absolutely. And they made it so it's contingent upon her.
Yep.
So there are rules that, to me, make it so it would be difficult to make them go back anytime, all the time.
Well, yeah. Xavier did it. He went forward to talk to himself.
Right.
But through the mind of
Wolverine.
He had to do it
through Wolverine, who was present in. So.
what do you guys think of this? Obviously, it's a great choice to have Wolverine.
Rules are fast in this.
It's obviously great to have Wolverine do this because, as we talked about, this whole thing is, it's on his back.
Right.
But a few deviations from the original comic, Kitty Pryde is not the one that, she's the one who actually does this
in
the comics, and it's Rachel Summers who has this ability to even do that.
Mm-hmm.
Did anyone find that off-putting? Because I had known as Kitty Pryde as just this person who walks through walls, and it's made no mention of that.
I questioned because I didn't know Kitty Pryde had the ability to project other people's consciousness in the future and in the history. So I didn't know if that was true to her character. Because you think Jean Grey would be able to do that.
Yeah, but you have this character who can project herself to three dimensions. Why not other dimensions? So, I mean, it's to me, it's an extension of what she does already. Yeah.
But and then if you also go off of the film, we see in The Last Stand, we see Kitty Pryde is in Xavier's class when he's talking about transporting people's consciousness from one body to another. So it would make sense that Kitty, being a pupil of Xavier, would know how to be able to do this, execute consciousness.
I sort of kind of want to see, I understand what they're saying. I want to see that cut part from the movie, that excised part now. The rogue part and Kitty,
Well, here's what it did was it negated the ticking time bomb.
Yeah.
Because then, you can just continue with that part of it, and ultimately they can perhaps save themselves.
I mean, for me, I've heard debate about this also. There was a couple of people saying that it was kind of very Hollywood for them to try and replace the leading female role with a male. Because if it stuck to the comics, it would have been Kitty Pryde going back, and it was sort of focused on her and not Wolverine. That, to me, doesn't bother me as much, because they have so many people to deal with, and we love so many of these characters, that you have to be able to, I guess, have a knowledge, have a base, have something to connect to.
Sure.
And if they had used Kitty Pryde going back, although we all love Ellen Page, like, we don't know as much about that character, and to have her be the anchor of this film and convincing everyone, I think would have been harder and would have needed more explanation to an already complicated movie.
But the bottom line in all of these movies, with the exception of First Class, Wolverine's the focal point. Mm-hmm. He's the one through which, you know, the audience has been traveling with since the first X-Men. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We follow him through there and getting involved with the X-Men, and where he Anna Paquin, who's mm-hmm.
a rogue.
You know, and then X2 is really, you know, again, it furthers him, and then in X3, again, more with the Stryker character. Yes, we have all these characters coming in. The only movie that Wolverine really didn't impact as much was First Class. Mm-hmm. He was only in it for that cameo. But what's great about it is that line, mm-hmm. that one scene, they use it in this one. But I think it's smart from a cinematic perspective. They picked a character and they've thus far run
smart
with that.
From a business perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Jackman is huge around the world.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and he is now. And again, I just recently watched the first movie. It was funny when he said, oh, everybody looks the same. And I'm like, when I see the first movie that came out in 2000, man, Hugh Jackman looked, I mean, oh, it's just crazy how young he really looked it, but he's weathered it well. And again, he, you know, much props to him for sticking around, because a lot of people might not have.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great through line, and he's a great supporter.
And also, I thought a big story for this particular film with the use of Mystique and her mutation, and that she's able to transform, which also helps with the Sentinels, because the whole Sentinels and X-Men, they have like different generations of Sentinels, and like the one that's used in this has evolved over time and has aided with the brink of extinction of these mutants. So I liked how they played with Mystique's mutation into the storyline as well, and made me question, because Jennifer Lawrence, her career has blossomed tremendously in the last few years, so it made me question if they helped build her storyline because she's such a big actress now today, that it would appeal to the audience as well during this time.
I mean, my gut tells me that probably, but I'm glad that she didn't take over as the focal point over Wolverine, because I was a little worried that could have been kind of more of the arc, that she was really going to be the star. And for me, like, Mystique as a character is always interesting to watch in all the other movies, but she's never been like the star of it. Right. And I am glad that they both gave her character more, gave her more depth, and like gave Jennifer Lawrence some opportunity, but they didn't let it take over the entire franchise.
Well, they're great because they work on mm-hmm. multiple levels. Because I mean, as soon as they meet up, right, which mm-hmm. we know is going to happen, all of a sudden Michael Fassbender, Magneto, just turns and is like, mm-hmm. "I am insuring mutants."
Yeah, I was like, "What the?"
That movement came out of nowhere.
What that? Oh, his decision to shoot her and stuff like that.
I was not expecting it, but I didn't think it was me.
Got me, and I was like, wait, when does she jump out the window? Because I remember seeing that mm-hmm. frame in the trailer, and I was like, I'm confused how this happens. And then he like whipped out and basically turned on her, and I was like, oh, now I get it.
Yeah.
But that was a great moment.
And that, you know, that was also a great opportunity to kind of take us back to the future, or whatever you want to call it, because, you know, of Wolverine's interruptions.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys ever get pulled out of the movie by, like, the time changes?
No. What John was mentioning, in the third act, I was wondering why they didn't cut back more frequently, and therefore he explained it. And I was, because I had the same inclination he did, I was like, I'm surprising they're not intercutting a little quicker.
Well, there's your answer. They wanted to.
He certainly wanted to. But
the only time I ever got pulled out of this movie was completely based on my own brain switching things. I'm like slightly dyslexic. Mm-hmm. And when they were pulling out the Sentinels, instead of it saying Trask, I read it as Stark.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, Stark? And I was like, for like 3 minutes, I was like, Wait, what's going on?
I'm Iron
like,
Man's in
are these
what?
Are these colliding? And like, I heard a little bit about the Quicksilver thing, and I was like, so confused. And then I was like, oh, trash.
To be fair, Iron Man was the first superhero that they encounter that is not a mutant in the comic books.
There
you go. You are correct in some sort of way.
My subconscious was telling me. I was so...
That was awesome. Would that have been if Stark Industries was involved with the X-Men weaponry?
Due to contract negotiation, I don't think that's going to happen.
I don't think we're going to see
really
that.
Like their divisions.
I
think it's the way, you know, we say contract negotiations because a lot has been said lately, too, regarding the Disney Marvel deal. Mm-hmm. And so right now it's just a question of when Sony and Fox end up, eventually they're going to lose the rights to these pictures, as well as Fantastic Four, because of, you know, Disney bought the whole kit and caboodle. Mm-hmm. And eventually, I guess, sometime, those are going to revert to Disney at some point in time. They're not going to remain those properties anymore. So that'll be interesting to see.
Because
Disney really wants to make this world, you know,
they
as they do in the comic books.
They want a
theme
want
park? Crossover, probably.
So let's talk. So I guess, you know,
park, which I will go to.
I want to.
We'll talk about the marketing. We'll kind of backtrack, but let's talk about the next kind of movies, because we know Apocalypse is coming out, and we know Wolverine. So that's 2016 and 2017. We have Wolverine,
right?
Mm-hmm. Another one.
Yeah.
Another one.
Yeah, another one. Directed by Bryan Singer.
A reboot?
No,
just a continuation.
Apocalypse is directed
And I think
Bryan.
Wolverine is going to be James Mangold again, maybe? I don't know if he signed on. Yeah,
I believe so. But so let's talk about Apocalypse. I mean, pardon the pun, the usual suspects are going to be back.
I'm also very... I mean, I think that I have some questions about this little button we had at the end about Apocalypse. But certain things that I was confused by, and like I feel like I need to go rewatch the movie, or you guys can answer for me. Was she a woman or a man?
It's a man.
Apocalypse is a man.
I know, but what did it look like in the film? I'm not talking about the comic book.
It looked like the mutant from The Last Stand that negated all powers, kind of, with tattoos all over him.
I was just like very confused, because to me, the visual looked so different than the comic that I was like, are they changing it up a little? Who is this? It didn't really seem to...
If I'm going
to
be, you know, I mean, going off of what John said, who knows? They might have just been like, okay, we got to get something, because that's the way he made it seem. So I don't know how much thought was actually put into making it look the way it's supposed to look. So we'll find out if that is now what they're stuck with.
I don't know, because like to me... I thought it was like a woman or something, and I was like, wait, I'm confused. And so I don't know if I might need to go back and watch.
I think that's going to be like the rise of Apocalypse. Like, that's a scene from his origin story of that character. Mm-hmm. But as he becomes evil and whatever, they seal him away. And then that's when you get to present time where he's sealed away.
Yeah, well, he's coming back in Apocalypse.
I think the way they're doing it, from what I've read, they're going to be like in the late 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be, you know, now it's a sequel to First Class, Days of Future. And
this universe, or this
particular timeline.
Yes, this timeline, I guess.
Yes, this new age. And, you know, obviously every one of the young kids is back. Obviously, they cast Gambit with Channing Tatum. A lot of controversy there.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of so McAvoy, Fassbender, Nicholas Hoult, Jennifer Lawrence, Hugh Jackman, and Evan Peters will reprise in their roles. So and we have younger versions of Cyclops and Jean Grey and Storm,
which will be very interesting.
Well, yeah, and I just one of the things that, you know, I don't know if, did you touch upon it? We'll talk about Easter eggs.
Sure.
In my research for Easter eggs came the ending, the apocalypse, and as for how Singer intends to explain the sudden appearance of Apocalypse in the new continuity during the 1980s, without ever mentioning him in the original trilogy, there's actually a comic book precedent that could be used, they're saying. So while X-Men Days of Future Past undoes certain original trilogy developments, such as bringing back long-dead characters like Cyclops and Jean Grey, the post-credits Apocalypse scene predates the altered timeline change up around 5,000 years. So again, this is another one of those time travel things that you can pull your hair, you know, pull the hair out of your head. But for whatever reason, did not come into face with the X-Men. As a result, we can presume that Apocalypse is awakened by or attracted to Logan's trip through time and the subsequent change in reality. So that could be one way. I mean, I'm not in these writers' heads. I don't know what they have going on.
I believe it's going to be Magneto.
You believe it's Magneto?
Apocalypse is the pure mutant. He is the first mutant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that on Magneto's leaving of this movie in Days of Future Past, he probably went, he's on his journey of self-discovery to find out the origin of all mutants. So it makes sense that he is researching Apocalypse without really knowing who he is, and he unleashes Apocalypse.
Oh, Magneto, always causing trouble.
But that would draw them back together and put Magneto back with Xavier. Because that's like the strongest mutant ever, so they have to all be teamed together. And
the
then they put adamantium on Wolverine.
There you go.
Way to wrap it
and
up,
then
Steve.
Phoenix comes to play.
Yeah, I was like, then you're going to need Jean Grey to help balance all of that chaotic craziness that's a bound to ensue.
And it's going to be a young Jean Grey, so who is this going to be played by?
Yeah.
Is there any hint on that?
Might have to Google.
Yeah, I don't think official news has come out. But, all right, I believe the last thing we... Well, I do want to do your Easter eggs.
Yeah, it's... There was a bunch for those comic book fans. The Lasting X is one of the top ones, and that's... You know, it's fitting that the movie should earn an extra... not from the studio. So in Days of Future Past, like all other X-Men movies before it, the X of the 20th Century Fox title card remains lit for a moment longer.
Yeah,
so that's always
they
one.
Did that in the last film. Mm-hmm.
What's in a year? The film starts with a bang, dropping audiences into a vision of the future. Does anybody? I didn't realize. Did they say what year it was?
Through math, it's 2023.
Future is being overrun with Sentinels. Now, the year in which the future is shown to be overrun with Sentinels and the Earth's population suffering at their hands is actually the year 2013. What are the odds that that would be the same year official production on the film actually began?
Interesting.
Interesting. Sentinel powers over... let's see, over the future premises established, the movie wastes no time in dropping the surviving X-Men into battle against near invincible future Sentinels. As is shown in the film, robotic sentries absorbing the powers of the mutants they fight thanks to their capture of Rogue, explained in our discussion, plot holes. The feature is shown as the powers of Sunspot and Iceman are turned against each other. Mm-hmm. But the Sentinels also show a few powers which would be familiar to fans of the past, specifically Spindly Claws of X2, X-Men United Deathstroke, and the Diamond Form X-Men's First Class Emma Frost, January Jones, and a rock form similar to that shown by Darwin before his death. So that's when Kitty Bishop and the Time Travelers, which I think we already discussed. Mm-hmm. Logan's souvenirs in his apartment, apparently. Hugh Jackman's Wolverine may have left a love behind when he returned from Japan at the end of Wolverine, but he was apparently fond of more than a woman. Jackman had teased prior to the film's reveal that eagle-eyed fans should take a close look at his circa 1972 apartment. At first glance, closer inspection, I should say, a home video release. Wait for a home video release, but the samurai sword and photo of Mount Fuji are on his wall that he had in the last Wolverine movie. Not to mention the brown, yellow, and white striped curtains paying homage to his classic costume.
Also, on top of that, he is introduced not as Wolverine in that scene, but by Jimmy.
By Jimmy?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, who else? Once Wolverine begins talking down the goons, the young woman, boss's daughter, with whom he'd been sleeping with, offer a word of protest calling him Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
The name may fly by casual viewers as a simple name he has adopted, but fans know that Logan's actual name is James Howlett.
Mm-hmm.
Since 1973.
And, if fans really kind of want to really dig into this, what's that website you're pulling all these from?
This is, I found this off of, this came off of Screen Rant. You actually have the link. I sent you the link to this.
Oh, cool.
There's just so many, and I think it's interesting because they do use some, like, verbally, some are set, but some are even just circumstantial. Like we mentioned him, like Wolverine going through the metal detector, or Wolverine being kind of squeamish on the plane. Like all of these are tied into past films, and I like it that they use them in all different aspects, in lines, in visuals, in everything. And it's not just like, oh, we have to throw in a line every so often.
Yeah, the running jokes that their fans will appreciate, because we know that Wolverine doesn't like to fly.
Yeah.
Well, and the creators of had Chris Claremont was in it for a bit. Len Wein was in it for a bit. So, yeah, no, they you know, listen, if you're a fan, and this is what I love about the Marvel movies, is that they put these little things in there, which are great. But, you know, as the casual viewer, I'm not the big Marvel thing. I just think the movie works from beginning to end as a time travel story, as a comic book movie. You know, we've been fortunate these past few years. We've had Captain America, great comic book version, and this movie. We're fortunate. We're lucky. Yeah. We're getting good stories, and you know, well, Marvel Studios.
Doing as we wrap this up, let's just really touch upon the kind of marketing and the reception. As we talked about, I mean, there's so many brilliant ways they had. We kind of mentioned a few of them, but they had three viral websites: TraskIndustries.com, TheBentBullet.com, referring to, of course, John F. Kennedy,
right.
And
was a great storyline, by the way. I don't think we've really mentioned too much about it, but that they added it and also add the turn halfway through, where it was him trying to save him and he wasn't
stop. That was a great twist.
It was a great twist
because I didn't see it coming. It was like I was trying to save him. That was a great twist.
Yeah,
he was one of us.
It was a good thought out like subplot.
I thought so.
And 25moments.com. And speaking of Jackman, I would appreciate this because I'm a WWE fan, but he made an appearance on Raw to help promote the movie, which is always great.
And they also released a bunch of videos. They didn't just release trailers, but they released video segments about the mutants, about going in like more in depth. Like for instance, I know they did a little video clip on Mystique, and they used footage from the film, and it was very similar to the trailer footage. But then they would do like the Mystique, alias is Mystique, name is Raven, powers are blah blah blah. And so they did do little kind of twists on their own trailer and put those up online.
And they did a fantastic job too of, like I said, retconning Last Stand. We've been picking on that a lot, but they've done a great job at re-educating an audience and bringing this back to the early roots that audiences really love to begin with. And First Class was really well received by critics and audiences alike. And I just think that by bringing the old and the new together, they made it in a way that's understandable. People could applaud, they could cheer and say, hey, I remember that. And I just think from a marketing standpoint, they re-educated an audience without it tasting like medicine, like being that it was forced on me. I was appreciative of new trailers. The posters that they came up with were fantastic. And, you know, they did a bang up job, I think, all the way.
In terms of, you know, as you're talking about getting kind of people re-educated and young kids, I mean, they partnered with CKE Restaurant Holdings, which owns Carl Jr.'s and Hardee's. And so they did like obviously a big push with those and kind of the X-Men, and it's because ultimately, you know, it was so funny to hear that the kids really understood it, because ultimately that's who X-Men is for, his kids. And then of course they partnered with Mountain Dew.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember Mountain Dew and the baseball thing?
You know, that made me, I was like,
but
going,
a lot of
Jesus,
Pepsi products are used Mountain Dew back in
then.
Film.
Yeah. But not back then. For some reason to me, Mountain Dew is like totally 80s. Not so much 1973. I don't just remember Mountain Dew in 1973, but then I researched Mountain Dew, and Mountain Dew's been around for a very, very long time.
But Mountain Dew is Pepsi, and Pepsi's used in a lot of film. I always see Pepsi products, and
Pepsi
hardly
had a big
ever see
screen
Coke.
In the Coliseum or whatever. The
I
arena.
Hardly ever see Coke, but Pepsi's used in like almost everything.
I know. Product placement.
Yeah.
I'm curious. There's a huge article about China just eating up this movie.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Really?
Like, obviously, it's very successful.
Because they got the original theme version. Talking about the. They have a different version.
On basically, you know, whatever the equivalent of like opening weekend is, but 6.5 million people saw it, which amounted to about $40 million, yeah. U.S. dollars. That is...
It's huge overseas. I mean, mm-hmm. yeah, in China being what, you know, in China is becoming a really... They're focusing a lot of news on China, especially on box office lately. And, you know, it's all about the import-export of American films because they used to not really allow that many American films to go in. Mm-hmm. They'd want to send a lot of their movies over. But now there's this resurgence, and they're a lot more American films now are embracing China. But they want people to start filming in China. And... they're even cracking down because a lot of theaters, too, in China have been scamming the audience people by either they're not reporting proper box office. They're scamming from the top, from the ticket takers, and China's coming down hard in those theaters. But when you look at it, I mean, to date, the total domestic gross is $124.5 million. The worldwide box office is close to $300 million. So that's, you know, superheroes do well, and the X-Men and Hugh Jackman, I think, is a part of that. You know, I think he's an international man of mystery, yeah. Or there's no mystery at all. People like him, and people like a good superhero movie. Mm-hmm. So,
and this one, it had time of this, but 91% according to critics ratings.
Mm-hmm. Rotten Tomatoes at 91% as of this morning. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's huge. You know, and so I know there was a lot of hype about this movie, whether or not it'd be good, but like it's living up to everyone's expectations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's what you want to, like, isn't
I think it helps
want?
That the other ones that came out prior to this didn't live up to people's expectations.
Well,
finally.
Yeah, I mean, it helps.
But you can, as mentioned multiple times, you can appreciate the past ones now because of this. Like, yeah. Okay, it all fits in somehow into the universe.
Yeah, and the cinema score in the movie is an A, which is really good for this. And, you know, you're getting a great cross-section of people, you know, going to paying their money to see this movie. The audience I saw it with was filled with, you know, men, women alike, kids, families, which is great.
Everyone.
I would say there may be a little bit skewed male, but there were a lot of women in the audience, and it was a sold-out show that I saw.
That's because of Hugh Jackman. He's a future ass. I think that's why.
oh, nice pun. All right.
What? I like the movie in general.
But it doesn't hurt.
I like Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, I like where this movie left us off with, because it left so many open doors and mm-hmm. new possibilities for mm-hmm. all these X-Men. Because now that like a lot of people have actually existed and are alive, mm-hmm. they haven't been killed. What other mutants out there have been killed and bring them back? And so it's just so many more people we could
and
see.
And now it's going to get into. I think now the problem is going to be like. We've talked about Hugh Jackman. He's been playing this role for quite yeah. some time now. And now he has to still stay in the same age for another how many movies?
I had heard that the next Wolverine movie, it might be the one where he hangs up his claws. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before. How long is it before an actor, you know, right. as much as he loves it, he's got to come to the conclusion.
Yeah, at some point. And anyway, wouldn't it be great if at some point he decides, okay, I'm going to hang him up? That would be an amazing movie. The death sequence or how he dies. You know how many people would be just mourning that?
If they kill him off, I can't see them killing him off.
I know, but I would love it if they did.
Not with
That'd
his
be
mutation or something. Like, it attacks his mutant gene.
Yeah, it just seems... I don't know.
It'd be great if they did. Send him off.
That day's going to happen. Again, we talked about this before, too. Same thing with, like, Robert Downey Jr. And, you know... But Hugh Jackman has been playing this role... God bless mm-hmm. him for a very long time.
Well, and also, like, Ian McKellen and Patrick Stewart, they thought True. That the last movie they did was going to be the last.
They were probably hoping, how can we bring this back?
I think they're appreciative of these roles because they've, mentioned how much they like them and their friendship. But that's, you know, they're not super young anymore. And how many movies can they do? These are very action-packed and they're strenuous.
Well, Kelling looks different.
He does.
Mm-hmm.
So, as we wrap this up, I want to leave fans on three fun facts that maybe you knew, maybe you didn't know. But bald actor Yul Brynner inspired the look of Professor X.
Oh.
Known from Magnificent Seven, Ten Commandments, King and I.
Yes.
Westworld.
Nice world.
Mm-hmm. The original X-Men were Jean Grey, Cyclops, Iceman, Angel, and the Beast, in that order. And
it was sad to see Angel's wings.
It was indeed.
Display case.
And the cover of the Uncanny X-Men number 141, the comic that starts the Days of Future Past story arc, is one of the most frequently paid homages in the comic book industry.
Oh,
fantastic. Okay.
So there you go. I'm glad it lived up to the hype. I'm glad we had John Ottman. Thank you guys for listening to us. Obviously, even though we went 2 hours and a half, I'm sure there are 8,000 things we haven't hit. So please, as fans, let us know.
No, you're right. You're right.
We can do another 4 hours, and we still wouldn't cover this.
No, you guys could. I don't think I could.
Thank you guys so much for listening. You guys have been great. You guys are the best fans. Let us know what you guys are thinking. Let us know your anticipation for Apocalypse. I know it's going to be 2 years, but we're going to blink, and it's going to be the Apocalypse. On behalf of Dimitri Panos, Sarah Stratton, John Comerford, John Ottman, Marissa Serafini, and Stephen Lemieux in the booth, who's played this thing like 20 times just because.
You know, I don't care. I love this theme song.
Anyway, we'll see you here. AnatomyMovie.com, Movie Anatomy on Twitter. We'll see you here for the next dissection.
Thanks. Bye, all.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.